Hey, it's Kevin Agani, host of the College Football Podcast with Herbie and Pollock. Hope everyone is enjoying their Thanksgiving. Interested in the dark side of college football? Do you know what a booster does or who the bag man is? How about how they affect recruiting or a coach's job security? Well, our friends over at The Right Time with Bomani Jones just finished a series about boosters in college football called Sideline in conjunction with the site Banner Society. We thought you'd like it and wanted to share it with you in its entirety. You can listen and subscribe to The Right Time with Bomani Jones wherever you find your favorite podcasts. Enjoy.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. It's a little weird doing that over a different beat, but this is our Sideline series in conjunction with Banner Society at SB Nation. We've talked about booster culture in college football. My man Spencer Hall, the best college football writer in America, helped us put together. He's here now to kind of let you guys know what we got going. And Spencer, this is basically like the stuff me and you really find fun.
Yeah, it's the stories you don't get to tell anywhere else about what college football really is. You see what's on the field and you hear a little bit about what happens off the field. But in reality, there's 365 days a year and somewhere around, 12, 13 or 14 of them are occupied by football games. Everything else that happens off the field is tied into pretty much everything else in life. And that goes for how you eat, how you pay for what you eat, what's over your head, and who's writing the checks for all of it.
Yeah, it's very human, right? And like with pro sports, mm-hmm. We do our best to try to make it where you only think about what's going on the field. And off the field, NFL stuff, really not that much fun. It can typically be very, very serious. Off the field, college stuff, all kinds of fun and bizarre, and by the admission of all parties involved, doesn't really make that much sense.
There's a curious side effect of not paying players and making things off book and taking cash out of the equation is this, that cash can clarify things. Cash can level out everyone's sliders in terms of priorities. When you take away cash, how are people deciding what they want and how they're going to fulfill those needs? Because when you take money out of the equation, suddenly we're all not on the same page. We're not even close to the same page. And that's when things can get kind of squirrely, because what if I want you to go to my school? I could pay you, sure. But that's going to be too upfront. Anyone who thinks that that still works, go watch Pony Excess. It didn't work in 1984, and it certainly doesn't work now. You got to be a little more creative. But on top of all that, the incentives and the emotions and the things that can get tied into that, they start to become about power. And power can be exercised in a whole lot of different, very, very strange ways. And sometimes they get tied up in college football, sometimes at the highest levels of power. It's not uncommon for a governor to butt their heads into college football. They'll have nothing to do with the pros. They'll have nothing to do with the NFL. But when college rolls around, man, the doors are open for all kinds of people to walk in that door.
Oh, yeah. So we got to talking about that. We also had a good one with Marcus Spears where he talked mm-hmm. about like being a player. And I think he said some things that people would not expect, which is the apprehension some players have when these people come waving around money.
Mm-hmm. Or how you can almost get involved in an arranged marriage in Louisiana, which very nearly happens to Marcus in his installment. That's my favorite part of the entire episode.
Our man Stephen Godfrey of Banner Society wrote a story years ago about the bag man, but it's such an interesting story, and his perspective on all of this is just fascinating.
Yeah, he does a great job in filling in the blanks between school and athlete and all of the people who sit in between, because if you think all politics are local, you're right. And they may, in fact, be more local than you realize, because that guy who works at the HVAC company or sold it for a couple of years ago is just sitting on like $8 or $9 million, and he's bored somewhere out there in the exurbs of Mississippi. He may very well be the bag man sitting next to you at the golf course.
Yes. And also, by the way, that guy that runs that HVAC company, you never know. His job might be to just go give somebody a whole new air conditioning system.
When you take straight cash out of the equation and you start filling in a lot of other different things, well, heck, the incentives package, it becomes very diverse indeed.
We also talked to Joel Anderson of Slate, and it's interesting because he is a college football player who didn't really play that much college football. I love you, Joel.
Yeah, he is maybe my favorite case in all of this. I think all four parts of this were really good, if I can toot my own horn. However, Joel's was the most interesting to me because it had the most things I'd never heard before, right? I've heard players talk about this, but I'd never heard Joel's perspective, both as a journalist and as somebody who was good enough to get onto a college roster, but wasn't good enough to get special treatment, right? That sort of limbo in between is a fascinating thing that he explores.
Yeah, like that's a guy who didn't need to get in no trouble while he was there.
That's correct. He's the one who wasn't special enough for special treatment, but was just good enough to have to play by all of the rules, right? Some of the rules are optional. I think Joel, to me, is like the slightly wealthy man. He's often the most miserable person in the room because can't retire, right? But you're not exactly like having a pity party for yourself, right? Like he was right there in the just privileged enough in terms of athletic talent.
Yes, but he also was the fastest 10-year-old in America.
Fastest 10-year-old American. Nobody could ever take that away from him, though. Remember, doesn't have the certificate anymore. So go ahead, drop those bombs on him. He can't back it up.
There we go. So you guys, check this out. This is our sideline series. For those of you who are checking this out the week of Thanksgiving, hope you eat good. Spencer and the Banner Society, man, thank you. This was a lot of fun to do.
No, man, it's always turkey time in college football. Eat up.
There it is. You guys enjoy. You and I, this is maybe our favorite thing to talk about in college football is two people who are fascinated by college football, which is the crazy people around college football who just give away their money.
Boosters, baby. It's time to talk about the bag men, or at least the men who fill those bags. And I should point out at the top, by the way, almost exclusively men. Almost exclusively rich men.
Interestingly, is there a woman, is there like a crazy female booster somewhere?
I can't think of a single lady booster who's really doing the kind of, you know, colorful, skullduggerous, sometimes unethical, sometimes outright illicit things that boosters do.
And you know why you can't find them? Because they're stupid. That's why.
It's a measuring contest of sorts.
Yes.
And it's a measuring contest that women are particularly uninterested in, at least in this way, right? For the most part, the people doing this, there ain't one type or one way of doing it, right? Like every single person who's behind this vast system has a slightly different strat and a little sort of edge to the way they do things.
So like on your list, old boosters, right? Because you follow college football enough, you know that there are a few like highlight boosters, like names we know. Like who's your number one?
And there are so many. You're asking me to pick one and that's cruel. But I think my favorite booster of all time, when you go, oh, could I give you the prototypical big sort of, can I say swinging? Just let me give you like the loudest, most Texas kind of swinging. And that's this. Joe Jamail. You and I both love Joe Jamail. I introduced you, I think, to the greatest Texas deposition ever.
Yes. Where he's ready to fight right there.
He gets someone so mad, he meets the challenge, and then everyone realizes that they're over 50, wealthy, and would get winded quickly. That's what happens. All right?
Fat boy.
And he does at one point call another attorney, fat boy. It's the thickest Texas accent you've ever heard in your life. Yeah, Joe Jamail, like master of torts, raconteur, a guy who was worth about, you know, $1.5 billion, just giving money to the University of Texas, among other things. He was a philanthropist on his own, but he put his name on the field, famously, at DKR at Texas, at their football stadium. And my favorite thing was after UCLA beat them 66-3.
Which I believe was the first game at Joe Jamail Field. Or it was,
correct.
I think it was the day they dedicated the field.
Yes, yes. And he said famously that I paid all this money to put my name on the field and how am I going to take my name off it? You know, how much I got to pay to take my name off the goddamn thing? Yeah, I think that was the actual quote.
Yes.
I don't think I'm actually coloring it up a little bit. I think I'm actually toning it down from what he said.
But the power of Joe Jamail is when it wasn't going so great for Mac Brown at Texas, the thing that Mac did when he got there that everyone has said is the wisest move that he ever made was he hired Joe Jamail as his lawyer. Right? Now, who knows how much legaling Mac actually needed in this time period, but Joe Jamail was his lawyer, and that saved his job through the bad times.
Correct. Now, this is getting to the meat of what we're talking about when we talk about what do boosters do and how do they exercise their power? Because you can't outright buy a college sports franchise. You can come close, But technically, you're not going to own it, especially if it's at a public university. It's just not going to happen. It's technically owned by the taxpayers of the state. However, as we all know, there's a lot of different ways you can flex. Jamail would do it by protecting Mac Brown. He liked Mac, right? Joe Jamail, by the way, having a personal intimacy with the Texas football program for years because he was a drinking buddy of Daryl Royal, who I will also put is no end to the connections here, right? When you get to guys who have this much money and are this wealthy and are sort of this charismatic and outgoing, which is one way to put what Joe Jamail was, and a real complimentary way to put it, right? He also would go on these nights out on the town with Willie Nelson. So the person who's sitting here putting his name on the Texas football field itself, that guy is going out with Daryl Royal, the Texas football coach, and Willie Nelson. So he's not coming short of cash, and he's not coming without the intent to at least, you know, flex on them a little bit, to exercise their power. And so much of this comes down to that, right? Just the need to either control, to push someone else around, to have their way.
Because I can is the explanation for so much booster stuff. And what gets lost in this is a lot of these programs, I guess it's changed now in more recent times because the television money is so much more. Donations could be 20 or 30% of an athletic department's budget.
Right. And they can be a bit more and have more impact if that person has more money. And there's an interesting thing that happens at scale here. You know, I started by talking about Joe Jamail, who was at Texas. I don't know if you know this or not, but Texas, not short on money. They'll tell you. They're very fond of telling people that they are not short on money. Another thing are large boosters. They have a number of people who give large amounts of money to the football program.
Among it's a problem.
It is a problem, right? Now, if you want total control of a program, well, you probably want to pick some place that's either down on their luck or historically has been overshadowed because of the lack of resources, right? The recently passed T. Boone Pickens, himself kind of a colorful figure, not quite Joe Jamail loud, but also real vocal, a corporate raider from the 1980s who came out of the oil industry. T. Boone Pickens managed to find himself in a position of extreme power at Oklahoma State, mostly because he had more money than everybody else. You know, that's the same story with Phil Knight. If you're one of these guys who can come in and be the biggest checkbook or the only real checkbook that matters at a place, well, you can swing it, can't you, right? At Texas, it's harder because there's going to be a competition. Everybody who's writing those checks wants to see who's got the biggest six shooter, right?
Mm-hmm. And then you get like a school like Texas A&M in regard to that, where the price of oil greatly affects the fortunes of the boosters. So when crude is riding good, everybody's winning. If oil prices fall, oh, you got a problem.
Yeah, and that doesn't just happen with things like people who are rich off commodities, right? Auburn had Bobby Lauder. To give you an idea of how long he was in play at Auburn as someone who mattered and who had sway and pushed people around, was appointed to the Board of Trustees at Auburn in 1983 by George Wallace.
I have been to the Bobby Lauder Center at Auburn, by the way.
It is quite a facility, is it not?
It was. They were very nice to me at Auburn. But he's a banker, right?
Yeah, was a banker. There was this whole 2009 thing that happened in the banking industry. Lauder took a bath. After that, his influence at Auburn began to wane. But not before a number of spectacular things that, despite his low profile, and this is the funny thing about Lauders, that whenever you read any profile of millionaire banker Bobby Lauder and mega booster Bobby Lauder, for years it would say, well, you know, he really maintains a low profile. Really? Because why am I reading about it? You know, all the time, if this is the guy who's really making all the calls there, because I shouldn't know his name. And instead, I know all of these things about Bobby Lauder. I know that in 1992, that the New York Times reported that Bobby Lauder and Auburn were looking at a number of possible coaches to take that job after Pat Dye. Don Nealon of West Virginia. Another one was Mac Brown of North Carolina. No shortage of people with experience, titles, conference championships, and presence applying for the Auburn gig. None of them got it. The guy who ended up getting it was Terry Bowden. And I know that Terry got it because he got all the answers for what they were going to ask him the night before from Bobby Lauder. Because he sat him down in a hotel room and said, son, this is what we're going to ask you. That's exactly what happened there. By the way, that's like One moment of intervention there, naming buildings on Auburn's campus and helping to choose coaches is another. But sometimes they help fire them, too.
Well, didn't Bobby Lauder jump on the plane to go see Bobby Petrino and see if he wanted to be the head coach, even though Auburn had a head coach?
Yeah, he did that, despite the fact that gainfully employed Tommy Tuberville still held that position. And in 2003, I believe, they made the trip up to Louisville to discuss things with one Bobby Petrino. Making it more interesting, yes. By the way, yes. Bobby Petrino, former assistant to Tommy Tuberville at Auburn. I'm sure that conversation went real well.
And then Auburn in 2004 went undefeated.
This is correct. Also, by the way, it set off a long chain of events that ended up threatening Auburn's accreditation with one of their accreditation agencies. It got complex.
And so the thing that's so interesting about this is, and everybody's got a different booster thing. Like, of course, the mammoth one is the SMU, we've got a payroll to meet Sherwood Blunt situation. Right? Like, and I love that 30 for 30 because it just explained, hey man, in the Southwest Conference, all these guys are working in Dallas in the 80s at these oil companies in these buildings, and they want to brag about their favorite teams, and they got more money than they know what to do with. And so what they do with it is just throw it on their college football programs.
Yeah. And like, if I can get across to anyone listening, this is bargain pimping. I mean, it really is. Like, to a billionaire or a hundred millionaire, a small amount of money and cast a very long shadow in these places, right? It's not like you need to control half the program. 20% will do. 10% will do. The budgets, they're real money, but they're not huge money. And you can do a lot with a little. And if you're somebody like Phil Knight, you can roll in and just, you know, control the place if you want to, right? Or as he did, do something really innovative and turn the whole thing into, you know, a marketing scheme for your product.
It is also amazing. It just really, guys that just wake up and be like, I will, guys that will not throw a quarter at a bum on the corner,
mm-hmm.
but they will throw money on these programs.
Oh yeah. People who are in sort of ruthless industries, like who funds Kentucky football? It's coal money. There's a lot of coal money. No, and it's not, you know, that's not a big kind of program. Okay, let's keep going. What kind of money gets you to dangerous? Well, you know, Len Wexler money. The Len Wexler, who has his name on pretty much everything at Ohio State, okay? It's the guy behind the Gap, the guy behind Victoria's Secret. You know, he did start it, but he bought it and turned it into what it became, you know, this former shopping mall retail baron.
The VF Outlet Malls, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that guy, just in terms of things he's attached to most recently, was the guy who was the only single client of Jeffrey Epstein. That's the kind of money that can pour into a program. And by the way, like Wexler is pretty similar to a lot of other huge boosters in that the athletic program is a piece of what they donate, right? They're giving to other things as well, you know, hospitals on campus or buildings or endowments, et cetera. But the one thing that everyone sees, the front porch of the university in a lot of cases, is the athletic program. And, you know, they're very conscious of that as well. They don't want their name on something that sucks, you know? And thus, when it comes down to exercise the power they hold, even though they're never going to see a dime out of it, they're going to take it.
Yeah, but like, who's, like, what are the schools that have boosters that aren't really good at this? Like, is it fair to say that at Tennessee now, that part of their problem is their boosters aren't that good?
You know, they're good at being there, right? They're definitely... They're definitely present. They definitely write checks. You know, Tennessee's like one of my favorite cases. They're not a unique case. There are a couple of these, but one of the biggest boosters, it's the Haslam family. And the Haslams, that name should be real familiar on two fronts, right? If you want like the ultimate kind of Tom Wolfe could not make this up in a novel about the South kind of thing, there's a Haslam that was the governor of Tennessee. And there's a Haslam who owns the Cleveland Browns. And they are part of the same family and the same business that, you know, got investigated by the FBI for skimming from their own contractors, I believe.
Not just any business. Flying J. Yeah, the key is pilot Flying J. Like, you've seen the Flying J truck stops? Yes, they are truck stop barons. They are the rich man's Stuckies.
They were allegedly cheating customers and defrauding them. And the FBI kind of, you know, got on them. That's the kind of level of finance where, you know, if you mess up, the FBI gets into your books, right? The DOJ takes note. Those are the people who are also, you know, in charge of the Browns and to some extent the Tennessee football program. They're not the only donors to the Tennessee football program. If they were, we probably wouldn't have had the Civil War that we had, right? The internecine warfare that became the Tennessee coaching search. And it all starts from that, right? Like, fundamentally, I think when the Schiano thing happened, people would say, man, we can totally blame the fan base. They don't understand what they're looking at. All of this starts with the decision makers and their own kind of like rivalries, faults, and fractures.
Well, let me tell you something else I think that is interesting that is happening. And I just thought of this right now, and I'm curious your view on this. So I am from Houston. We have a very interesting animal in college sports, which is the University of Houston, which I think is a far more compelling case, like thing than people realize. The University of Houston was at the forefront of Southern integration in football. They were at the forefront of Southern, I mean, of integration in Southern basketball. They also have engaged at points in some of the most rampant cheating that anybody has ever had, with Bill Yeoman handing out stacks of cash in the locker room in the 80s, right? Like, this is what Houston has been. But Houston, I forget what year the university was founded, but it's like a relatively new school. It's smaller than all these other ones, but they got great geography and they have a huge alumni base and they got people who really, really, really want to win. And so at all these different steps in the process, they have been at the forefront of this is what we got to do to win. And now they have Tillman Fertitta as the guy who gives away all of their money. Now, we have all these other schools now that are popping up, like North Carolina Charlotte, for example, got themselves a football program. Liberty has a football program that they care a lot about. We are kind of getting to a place where we're going to get like generation two on some of these boosters because, hey, man, there's somebody that went to all these schools, like Georgia State, for example. One day, all Georgia State got to get is the right graduate, the right guy who wants his school to be the one.
The more money that piles into a program correlates with success. What was Oregon football before Phil Knight got serious about Oregon football? It was Oregon football pre-Phil Knight, which wasn't much, man. I mean, it was a place where Oregon hung its name on Animal House and Ahmad Rashad. That was about it.
Bobby Moore.
And like Steve Prefontaine, right? Now, note, like Steve Prefontaine, legendary runner, you know, huge figure, a myth. Mythical figure in American running, that's not going to carry you like Marcus Mariota will, right? It's just not going to do that. And that's really what we're talking about when we talk about, okay, well, do they matter? Yeah, they especially matter to places like Houston, where Tillman Fertitta, another double owner, by the way, right? Since he's right there on the Rockets and is very busy at the moment of this recording. He's learning all kinds of interesting geopolitical facts right
now. I'm up to my elbows, right? Like, he is from Galveston. I'd love to know, like, what idiom he uses to refer to what his situation is right now.
Busier than a dog with four asses, something like that. Yeah. He's, like, dipping deep into the idiom bag, right? To get his point across, right? And by the way, I really hope he uses one of those with like a Chinese translator who's like, what do you want me to do with that, man? We don't like, God, I speak, now you're asking me to speak three languages. Like when you get somebody into like deep country, like that, this, now I got to be trilingual. Come on, man. I don't make enough money for that.
Yo, he's from the Galveston docks.
Yeah. It's,
and he runs casinos.
Yeah, so that pretty much explains where we're going to have to start when hiring a translator, right? There's two people in the world who can do it. You can't pay them enough. The one place he doesn't need translation at all is that everything in college football speaks his language, which is money and hustle, right? Yes. That's it. He wants, like, Tillman Fertitta wants Houston in a major conference. You know, he wants Houston to compete for national championships. He'll go and snag another, like, hiring Holgorsen. There were a lot of legitimate reasons to hire Holgorsen, but you know what one real reason to hire Holgorsen was? And it was this, to show that they could do it.
Yep.
That's it. Not just that's our guy, but we have gravity, right? If you don't respect us, watch. We'll make you. We'll take your stuff. We'll take your recruits. We'll take a coach from a Power 5 program. That's the whole point of that. If you think like, yeah, it made sense. But there's another thing too, which is my money is long and my money is strong and it will come to your doorstep and take whatever it wants.
And this is what we have like everywhere. Everywhere. Mm-hmm. There's one or two and they are the most fun stuff about this whole game.
I mean, they do things differently, but it's all the same thing, right? Like, okay, Alabama, can you name a single booster? You might be able to name Paul Bryant Jr.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say. The most fascinating one, the dude that was grandfathered in.
Yeah, that's one guy you go, okay, well, he was grandfathered in. That guy has had, like, if you look at the most important figure in Alabama football, period, over the course of the program, the person who's had as much influence over it as his father is Paul Bryant Jr. Count the championships, the impact that he's made, and count the difficulty of what he's doing in the modern framework and compare it with his father. And if there's some issue about equaling your dad but not being able to coach football, that should be by the wayside now, because the hiring of Nick Saban and the booster presence at Alabama, you know, they've arguably exceeded what Bear Bryant did there. You know, I think they did it in a more difficult time. I think they did it with greater efficiency. Like, it's every other year under Nick Saban. Just book it. They've won 5 out of the last 10, I think. That's a way better average than Daddy ever managed.
Yeah.
And that's the greatest football coach of all time.
The tricky thing on that is, like, so Bryant's career has 3 eras. A run of almost a decade of pre-integration success, a run of about a decade of post-integration success, and like 5 years in the middle that are awful.
Uh-huh.
like if you go look at his wiki page and then get to the coaching record and you start looking at ranks and stuff like that, there's this thing in the middle, and then something like 1971 comes. He's like, mm-hmm. Hey, fellas, come on, man. We got to let this go, man. I can't keep doing this, man.
Mm-hmm. There's that and this. Like, this is, by the way, all covered up when people sort of cover up how much ground they lost in pre-integration and then the conversion to an integrated college football universe. The big cover there was like, well, then he switched to the wishbone.
Like that too?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, but you know, like playing to a tie in the Astro Blue Bonnet Bowl in 1970 and having a 3-4 record in the SEC, being tied for 7th, y'all, that's not just the wishbone.
I can't keep living like this. Like that was his thought. I can't keep living like this.
No. Like, hey, listen, do you know how much I smoke? Do you know how much I drink? Do you know what the stress on top of all this is going to do to me? Y'all. And this happens when Alabama does things. It does them quietly. That's their MO. They do things quietly. They do them efficiently, but just as loud in their own way as anybody else. Like the boosters surrounding the Alabama football program, it's an interesting mix of old and new. If you look at it, like there's, you know, a family from like Mobile is one of the big boosters, right? And they control like a lot of the interests around the port of Mobile, some old coal money that is around Birmingham. If you want to follow this particular money, coal mines in Columbia. That's what one of Alabama's big booster families is tied up in. It's like, you know, like, hey,
the Columbia with 2 O's?
The Columbia.
Oh.
Yeah. They're tied up in that. And by the way, the family of one of those boosters got tied up in a wild extortion case involving human rights that, again, a little too long to explain here. They got tied up in like an extortion racket with human rights accusations involving coal mines in Colombia. Yeah. The connections that college football has are much stranger than people really even know. The Culver houses are a big family there. And then there's the Bryant fortune, right? Which is all, by the way, also tied up in like the board of trustees.
Yes.
That oversees the University of Alabama system, like for the entire state, which is why Jimbo Fisher is currently at Texas A&M, because Jimbo Fisher at one point, remember, was offered the UAB job. They viewed UAB as such a potential threat. Even the smallest threat is a potential threat for Alabama that they canceled the hire effectively.
Yes.
And made them go get somebody else. And that's why Jimbo Fisher ended up at Florida State first. They would have had him at UAB, but they decided, you know, as boosters who have established an entire system of doing things in the state to the point all to protect Alabama football, right? And the University of Alabama by extension, because they don't separate those two things, by the way, right? At Alabama, the interest of the football program are the interest of the university. And by extension, are the interest of the state. That's the argument, right? That if you just look at the way they've sort of built things in Alabama, it carries all the way through.
This is my man Spencer Hall. Check him out at Badass Society, SBNation.com. And we are collabing. It's me and you. It's a Voltronic sort of situation where we got this whole series. We're going to do this every other Tuesday through October. and November. Spencer's up first. We're going to have Stephen Godfrey of SB Nation on. Man, wrote that great story about the bag man a couple years ago. We'll talk about that. We got Marcus Spears at ESPN, who is excited to talk about this stuff, just so you know. He's so excited to talk about this. And Joel Anderson of Slate will join us on this. This has gone basically so far exactly as I would have hoped, because this is all so hilariously absurd.
Listen, man, we didn't even get to Phil Knight wearing a headset just so he could listen in. Just remember, just sitting in the booth on TV with a headset on, you know, just so he can hear. That's all, y'all.
Money, man. It's wild stuff. All right. And now joining us from ESPN to SEC Network, 2003 national champion, Marcus Spears.
My man, Bo, what's up, brother?
What's going on, man?
Glad to be here, bro.
You was excited anytime to talk about this.
Anytime you hit me up, I'm excited, bro, to be honest with you, man.
Yo, I love this. This is one of our favorite topics. Yes, like, I love, like, me and Spencer talk about this all the time. We're like, look, man, booster stuff around college football is the most entertaining.
It's
like,
so real.
The most entertaining thing. And you were a big-time recruit, big-time college football player. Now, I wonder this with you. When did you realize that, like, playing big-time college ball was in your future? At what point?
I think it was my junior year in high school, man. I start to, you know, you get the letters and you get questionnaires first. Mm-hmm. And, I got a couple my sophomore year, but my junior year, they start flooding in. And then I filled them out, went to a camp, and supposedly this camp ranked all the high school players. So I left the number one tight end in the country. I played tight end in high school. And then I started getting mail crates of letters.
Really?
Right. And then that's when the game changed. Like, it was like, it was offers as opposed to trying to get to know you. And it was offers. So then I had the experience with my coaches of getting pulled out of class to meet Bobby Bowden and Nick Saban and, Lou Holtz at the time. And I'm a football junkie. So I was like, damn, Bobby Bowden came to Southern Lab in Baton Rouge to meet with me. So, that's when I knew. Junior year is when the mail crates start coming.
Now, see, this isn't – you were in an interesting place, at least in the way that I look at things, in that you were from Baton Rouge.
Yeah.
There's no way that they can let you go anywhere but LSU, right?
Man, listen, Bo, it was so different. It's funny, man, when we had this conversation because you know a lot about BR. You know, I didn't grow up an LSU fan. I really was like, forget LSU.
Oh, you see, you know what? You have that age, though, right? Where it's only recent now that everybody is on the program.
Dude, I'm telling you, man, Southern University was the only college that existed for me.
Right.
In Baton Rouge. But I knew I wanted to play big-time college football. So for me, that was Florida State, Miami, Michigan. Travis Minor, Warwick Dunn had went to Florida State. We had a bunch of great players from Louisiana in general or Baton Rouge that went. Reggie Wayne went to Miami. Like, dudes wasn't going to LSU like that.
Right.
Right? I think Kevin Falk was like the tide turn guy that signed with LSU. Kevin Falk was like a god in Louisiana in football. And when he went to LSU, everybody's eyebrows raised and was like, okay.
Yeah, and people need to know, Randy Moss was the number one recruit that year.
Yes.
Kevin Falk was number two.
For sure. So he was the game changer, I would say, as far as kids looking at LSU. And then when Nick Saban came in and the recruiting pitch with Jimbo and just talking about what he was trying to do, I didn't know Nick Saban from Adam. Mm. I didn't even know Michigan State had a football team. Right?
Right.
But when he came in, I just respected so much of what he said because he technically told me, don't make a 4-year decision, make a 40-year decision. That was number one. I'll never forget that today. That's like one of the first statements he said to me. And he said, look, I know you are a All-American in high school. I know you're the number one tight end in the country, but you're going to have to earn your way to play. And no other coach said that. Every other coach was going to change their offense. I'm like, coach, you ain't through to the damn tight end in 7 years. Like, so now you found that guy. So it just changed for me in that regard.
Now, I asked this question. Around that time, is this when you start hearing from the grown-ups around town about how LSU is the place you need to go?
No question, dude. Every time you hit the grocery store, you find yourself in new places like the mall and people starting to recognize you. And LSU was just – it seemed like something about LSU came up every time I was in public.
Mm-hmm.
And it was funny, man, because for me, I was a kid that grew up in South Baton Rouge, which was 3-4 minutes down the street from LSU campus. I had never went on the campus. Like, that just wasn't my history. My grandmother lived in North Baton Rouge, Schuylerville, Louisiana, and that was right by Southern Campus, and that was home for me. Like, I was comfortable. I knew my whereabouts, surroundings, everything. South Baton Rouge, where my mom lived, you know, I was in the neighborhood. Right. I wasn't really doing much on LSU campus. That was like the don't go place.
Right.
So yeah, man, it was, it's funny how that thing transitioned, man. Cause I was not, LSU was not the place for me.
How hard were they trying to get you?
Dude, it was so crazy because here's the thing. The thing that Nick Saban changed was he was saying, if I let the number one tight end, and at the time we had the number two wide receiver, which was Michael Clayton. We had the number one defensive end in Louisiana, Marquise Hill. Andrew Whitworth was the, like the number three offensive tackle. So this year was like all the players were in Louisiana. So his whole mantra was, man, if I let them out, we ain't gonna ever recruit a good recruiting class. Right. And he just, it was the spiel. It was like, you could win a national championship. You can always come back to Baton Rouge. You can do whatever you want to do in this city if you have success and if you guys put the work in. So that was his pitch. Like, don't make a 4-year decision.
Right.
Make a 40-year decision.
Right. Now imagine once you get on campus, now's when you start learning about these boosters.
Dude, let me tell you something. So you constantly trying to figure out like, where all this money coming from? Like, where all these new buildings coming from? What the hell is in LSU case? What is Tiger Athletic Foundation? What is this, right? And then you start to see like millionaires and these dudes that got all kind of access to practice and being able to be in games and on the sideline. And, you know, as you become a player and I'm becoming an All-American, I'm starting to look around, especially my junior year when we won the national championship. I'm like, who are all these new people? and then was the dudes, the supporters of the program. And, they just, you know, in whatever way, they could support.
And then I guess you get to meet a couple of them. You're like, what's that dude do? Oh, he runs a bank.
Exactly. Right? Like, you know, it was a bunch of that, you know, and it was, you have the staples. Like, I think in Louisiana, you had Lemoyne Company. That was a big construction company. You had Shaw Group. You had All-Star Chevrolet. You had, the owners of these places were big LSU boosters. So, you know, we built a new log cook facility. We built a hotel while all this transpired when I was on campus. Like, all of these new things. And you're like, damn, these dudes giving $3 million to the program. They giving $1.5 million. You like, let me get some of that bread, man. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, because they try to keep, on one level, the NCAA wants to keep the boosters away from the kids because yeah. they don't want the boosters to give the kids no money. But the whole reason that the boosters are around is because they want to be around the kids.
No question. No question. Look, this is not, first of all, if you don't think this has been going on, you're stupid, right? You've been around ball. If you pay enough attention to college football, you know boosters play an integral part. And Bamani, the thing, I think the misconception is this. Boosters ain't handing players no checks.
Right.
Right? This ain't really happening like that. I tell people all the time, like, I didn't get a dime to go to LSU. Now, if I knew other dudes were getting money, I damn sure would have asked for some. But I didn't get a dime to go to LSU. I didn't, there was no school that offered me a bag, per se. So, I always feel a little bit like dudes kind of embellishing or they lying flat out, period. It's hard, and it happens. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but to say that this coach came with a, with 50,000 in a duffel bag, that's, you lying. That's just, that's stupid.
Or they ain't get that bag to you.
They ain't get that bag to you. It was somebody else that matriculated down to you. But jobs, you know, I was in school when the NCAA first allowed players to work. So I had a job and I worked. I ain't naming no names, but money, cause I ain't throwing them under the bus, but I worked. And I would go in, and I would literally do my hours because it was a job that I liked. But I know cash that wasn't there getting paid. Like, it is what it is. And I think a lot of times, man, I've always had this, and as we talk about this pay for play and as we have these conversations, I've always had in the back of my mind that we should be able to profit off of that.
Right.
So you don't look at it like that.
Well, the thing that always gets me about those dudes is, to a degree, they just feel like doing it, right? Because it seems like, because once you're already on campus, they don't really have to do anything for you. Like, these cats seem to, like, really, and, you know, sometimes it's a little weird, right? Because I imagine you got some hangout invitations that were like,
what? Let me tell you this. This is actually the deterrent. Now, you got some dummies in college that do it. This is the deterrent. And I tell players this now. Dude, once you take bread from them, you in bed with them.
Yep.
Like, that's what players have to understand. But money, to bro, I got offered bags in college after I became an All-American successful. And like dudes, like whatever you want, Marcus, you want a car, you want whatever you want. And I never took it because I didn't want to be in bed with them. What this mean, right? I was born to that, like I was from those type of neighborhoods where people just don't give you stuff.
Right.
Without an expectation for you to do something later or whatever. So I think for me, that's what kept me individually out of it. And I know a lot of dudes that I went to school with, that's what kept them out of it. Like, dude, if a dude give you a $60,000 car, if he give it to you, right?
Right.
He expect you to do something when you make it.
Right.
Like, that's just, that's understood. Like, this is not just about the success you having in college. So I think a lot of times that deters players more than anything. And then you got guys in desperate situations that's like, man, forget it. I need this.
Right. Like, what was the weirdest thing that a booster wanted to do? Because they be asking you to come to birthday parties and all this stuff.
So this dude wanted me to come to his daughter's Sweet 16. Now, I'm 18. Right? And he wanted me to come to his daughter's Sweet 16 party. And I'm like, yo, I can't come to that party. Like, these girls, like, I'm 18 now.
Right.
Like, this is not, and it's in my age demographic. It ain't that part. And I'm like, damn, man, I would love to go, though. I would love to go because she gorgeous. So right. I would love to go.
But what's so funny about that is that can't be what she wanted for her Sweet 16.
That ain't what she wanted. Exactly. And at the time, I'm 18. I'm not thinking that. I'm like, yo, like, listen, I'm not going because I don't want you, you know, whatever. I don't want to get in trouble. And I don't want that, all that to be out. Because once you do that, with that word of mouth, and they going to be like, Marcus was at our party. And there ain't no reason in hell for me to be at the party.
Right.
Other than your daddy love LSU and he got me to come. So that was probably the weirdest thing. And then I thought he was trying to do like a fixed marriage situation too. So I'm like, dude, like I'm not coming over there to meet your daughter at a Sweet 16. So that was, for me, that was weird, but you always get asked for, you know, birthday parties or come meet these guys that is, you know, standing on the sideline or I got some guys on campus. Can you come shake their hand and say hello and take pictures? You always get asked that. But monetarily, bro, I tell you something, bro, what kept me too, man. My mom told me when I was trying to decide whether I was going to go to the draft or not, right? My junior year, I had a great year. We won national championship. Everybody was on their high horse. I was like, Mom, if you need me to go, because we ain't had no bread. We ain't had no money. Well, I was like, do you need me to go? Like, I'll go if you need me to go. And she was like, boy, I've been broke 20 years. One more year ain't going to hurt us, right? So that's what really summed it up for me. But I saw a lot of dudes have to jump because they had to take care of their people, or they were so afraid of having to take money from boosters and dudes that was offering them things that they just didn't want to deal with it. So they go to the league and all of that becomes legal. Here's the thing players need to understand about boosters, though. Once you go to the league, they on to the next.
They don't know you.
They don't know you. They don't know. They can't know you. Right? Or you have those ones that's like super overzealous and they want everybody to know what they did for you. Mm-hmm. Right? So that's, you play Russian roulette with it.
Yeah. Like, how much room do you have to tell those guys no on stuff? Like when they want you to do something while you're in school?
Man, you have so much room because you can always use the NCAA. Right? But you don't want to. Think about it, Bo. Like, think about this, man. I'm going to give people this scenario for say, oh my God, these players are so great. You're 16 years old. You're in a situation like I was. You're 16 years old. Your mama working her butt off, trying to take care of a single parent, trying to take care of you and your sister. And a booster tell you, hey, man, we'll pay you $5,000 to come to a birthday party. What you going to do? You know what I'm saying?
Right.
These are the things that the NCAA and people that don't have that dilemma expect you to just be easily saying, no, I don't want to do that. Are you crazy? Like, dog, when I was 17, I thought $5,000 was life-changing money.
Yes.
Right? So for somebody to ask me that, for me to turn it down, the only reason is because my mom would always tell me, like, don't go out there and do nothing for nobody that you don't know, or don't take nothing from nobody that you don't know, because they going to come back and ask for it.
Dog, you talking about $5,000. I remember I had an internship when I was 21. And that internship paid $5,400 a month. Right. In 2002. So I ain't never heard nothing like this in my life. And my first paycheck was a 1 week check and it was for $1,000. And I looked at it and I looked at my dad and I said, and I did not grow up anywhere close to broke.
Right.
I looked at that check and I looked at my dad and I said, see this? This is how people sell out. That's what I thought about $1,000, right? Like $1,000. It never, so I can imagine somebody walking up with me with five.
Dude, at 17.
To do nothing.
And you 17, dog. Like I thought, dude, at 17, I thought $5,000 could buy you a house and a car. Like that was exactly, I was like, I can get a house and a car if I go to this birthday party. But hell no, that, I mean, you just, you know, you either selling your soul, or it all work out where you don't. I went to Lester Earl was in school before me.
Oh, Lester.
You remember that?
Yeah.
And Lester took money and rolled on everybody. He told on everybody. And that's the Russian roulette you play.
You know, Lester Earl Jr. is now playing college ball, yeah. Which made me feel very,
I'm
very
just glad
old.
He don't have to take no bread. Hopefully.
Yes. You'd hope, right?
Yeah.
There was another one of the, oh, Tony Cole.
Tony
dude,
Cole?
That was the other Baton Rouge dude that set the house on
Tony
fire.
Oh, man.
He set Georgia on fire.
Golly, bro.
So, because the schools, I think they're in an interesting position too, because the boosters are the money.
Yep.
And so, as much as they might want to try to rein these dudes in, how do you tell the money no?
You can't. And that's the thing, man. Like, the thing about it is, it's two separate entities that work for one common goal. Right. They have their way of going about it. The school has their way. Well, the school has their guidelines.
Yes.
Of going about it. So it's almost like they try to disassociate themselves when it comes to the black market. But you can't, because the same dude that's over there trying to get your star player to come to a birthday party so he could justify giving them whatever is the same dude that's going to be at the games on the sideline with access to the head coach and the coaches because he donating so much money to the program. So to try to differentiate that as a player, to try to separate the two when both of them are really looking for the same thing, right?
Right.
It's just hard to decipher. So, you know, that's why you got to, dude, you got to have level head. I'm trying to teach a little bit too while we talk about it. You got to have a level head and you got to have the ability to say no. Because the moment you say yes, you in.
Yeah.
You in. And then you subject it to, you don't even have to piss the booster off. The school can piss the booster off and the booster like, oh, I did this for all of them. And now you in a situation. But I ain't saying it don't happen.
Yeah. I wonder also, cause that was before Saban had all this clout, right?
Yeah.
That's back when he had to put up with those dudes.
Exactly.
Cause I bet he ain't got to do it now.
No, the more you establish yourself as a coach, you could tell them, look, I don't want you around my program. Practice off. Like you can't nobody come to practice. So you got to earn it. But as a new coach that's trying to get ingrained and embrace the culture and the atmosphere, you got to play the game.
And Saban didn't know really nothing about the South at this point. I remember him telling a story about going to one of those clubs that you go, you know, around town.
Yeah.
And some old lady raised her hand and was like, if I see another corner 7 yards off the line of scrimmage, I'm going to kill somebody. It's like somebody's granny. And that's when he realized, oh,
it's real,
this place is different.
Yeah, yeah. And he still regrets, I don't care what nobody say, he still regrets leaving at LSU.
LSU would be Miami if Saban.
For sure. Because
it's a lot easier to win at LSU than it is to win at Alabama.
No question.
Right?
No question. And, no question at all. And if he would have got Drew Brees, he might have not ever been at Alabama.
Oh, that was his?
He was trying to get Drew. Remember they got Dante Culpepper?
That's right.
Yep.
That's
they
right.
They wanted Drew, but they wouldn't clear Drew because of the shoulder.
Yep.
But that's the thing. Like when Nick, we all came in green. I tell people that all the time. Like we literally built LSU from being a program where good players came through every once in a while to the class before us with Brady James and Corey Webster and Trell Faulk. We a bunch of dudes that had success went to the league and played well. 2001 changed everything for LSU though.
SEC championship year.
Yeah, man. That was Saban. That was Rohan David. That was Josh Reed. That was the number one recruiting class in the country. It was everything. And the foundation for the 2003 national championship we won was all 01 guys being veterans and understanding their role.
Yeah. And people don't get, if you're of a certain age, you don't know this. LSU has not always been good.
Oh, you kidding me, dog? But money, we never talked about LSU.
No, ever.
Pre 98, when they had the big win against Florida, I think, or something like that, 96, maybe 96 or 98, whenever Kevin Faulk went there,
mm-hmm.
and they had them big wins, that's when people started saying, oh, LSU. And then when I went to my first game, I was like, damn, this is a crazy good atmosphere. But they still wasn't like quite over the hump.
Yeah.
Winning a few games, you could see that Saban was a good coach and all of that. But 01, it was like, all right, we all in now.
They needed to get a little farther away from the bad old days of segregation.
Because
what you talk about with Southern is the way, like, my whole people's side is, it's like an LSU thing.
LSU
is very
went
new.
Black.
Yep.
The AD right there, the AD right now at LSU, Scott Woodward. Scott was there. He might have been the associate AD at the time. Skip Berman was the AD. LSU wasn't no place black dudes wanted to go. Not from Louisiana.
Mm-mm. That's how Texas was. That was the issue. Texas has won 7 outright conference championships in 45 years.
Seven.
Dude. And that's because it took a long time before they wanted to go there.
We I'll never forget, man. The year we won the national championship, we had one white dude starting, Jack Hunt. That was an anomaly.
Yeah.
Everybody saw the turn, but at the same time, Nick Saban, Scott Woodward, Jimbo Fisher, they didn't hide from that.
No.
They knew it was some bad racial problems. They knew it was this whole demeanor that black athletes from Louisiana that were elite didn't want to go to LA. They knew all of that, mm-hmm. right? So they did their homework. They was like, we got to get these dudes.
Yo, Nick Saban trying to win these games. Like, I remember when Blake Sims started at Alabama, and there would be people I'd see, you know, random people on Twitter, so I don't want to act like it's too many of them. They'd be like, yo, man, you know, Nick Saban down at Alabama, he don't want that. I'm like, nah, I don't think you really understand what we talking about here with this dude. He ain't got no time
for none of that.
He had Rohan Davey out there in 2001.
Chopping that thing. You heard me? When Blake Sims broke records.
Yes.
At Alabama, dog. You better look, one thing you ain't never got a question about that man. He out there trying to get that dub, cause it don't matter about nothing else.
One last thing before we get out of here. You came up in the SEC. Do you like, and people say it's just different in the SEC. And in this space, do you think it's fiercer in the SEC with the booster world than it is in these other places?
It's not even close.
Really?
Not even close. Think about it, Bo. Just from a geographical standpoint, how many SEC towns got pro football team?
Right.
That's all you need to know. The reason why I firmly believe Vanderbilt struggles because there's so much other entertainment there, right? When you go to Alabama, you going to play football.
Yeah.
You ain't going to – what you going to Alabama for? When you go to Mississippi, what you going to Mississippi for? You know what I'm saying? You right. know me, dog. Look, I go to these – I grew up in Louisiana. I'm not trying to throw shade on Bama or Mississippi. I grew up in Louisiana where the LSU Tigers are bigger than the New Orleans Saints.
Right.
Okay, well, nobody say. Right now, as good as the Saints are, if you polled and said what's more important to you, who wins and who loses, it'll be 95-5 LSU, right? You look at all of these, South Carolina, you look at Georgia, you look at, like, dude, it's not even close, bro.
Oh, yeah, in Georgia, the Falcons' whole steez is a UGA impression.
That's it.
They hold you, like, they basically were like, we gonna make the Pro Bowl.
You better embrace it. You better embrace these SEC schools if you gonna have success.
And Georgia wasn't even good.
No.
they weren't even good. No. They were like, this is what we gonna be. We're gonna put you in black, silver, and red, and we gonna try to make this happen.
It's not even close. It's not even close. The Saints seat 70, LSU seat 105. Like, play a game on the same day. That's what I tell people all the time. Let them play a game on the same day. It'll be a bad look down there in New Orleans.
Hey, man. That is Marcus Spears. Check him out, ESPN, SEC Network. My man, you know I appreciate it.
As always, bro.
All right, we'll be back in a minute to talk about the Bag Man with Stephen Godfrey of Banner Society, but first, a word from Manscaped. Fellas, listen up. Have you heard of Manscaped? They offer precision-engineered tools optimized specifically for male grooming and hygiene. Grooming is essential nowadays, but a lot of you are still hesitant to manscape. You're afraid you might cut yourself, and that's understandable. That's why this revolutionary company, Manscaped, has redesigned the electric trimmer. Their Lawnmower 2.0 has proprietary advanced skin-safe technology, so it will not nick or snag your skin. The Lawnmower comes inside their Perfect Package 2.0, which makes a great gift this holiday season. It is literally everything you need for a nick-free manscaping experience every time. It's time to gear up and get all the guys in your life, as you, your brother, your friends, the gift of shaving this holiday season with the Manscaped Perfect Package 2.0. Go to manscaped.com to try the Perfect Package 2.0 and get 20% off and free shipping with the discount code BOMANI. That's discount code BOMANI. Give a great gift this year and get 20% off with free shipping. That's manscaped.com. Use the discount code BOMANI. All right, joining us now, his name is Stephen Godfrey. A couple years ago, you wrote a fascinating story about the bag man, college football. And the bag man is basically the dude whose job it is to deliver whatever inducements, shall we say, are there to be delivered to get a college player to go to a particular school. And we are talking about things that you're not supposed to do, but you know it's life.
It's the kind of recruiting we're not supposed to be talking about, period.
Yes,
right?
But it's, of course, the most fun stuff,
right?
Oh,
of course.
It's the whole reason why we're here.
When all these coaches say that they're great recruiters, right, that they get awards for this, the Broyles Award, you know, this always goes to guys who are like, well, he's always been historically a great recruiter. You know, that just happens on their own, right? That's just the charm in the living room. Not anything to do with anything else.
I was talking to somebody about the University of Houston the other day, and I would actually, the more I think about it, I kind of want to write a book about this, even though I'm not qualified, and the reason is, Houston was at the forefront of integration in football in the South. They were at the forefront of integration in basketball in the South. And were at the forefront of cheating of football in the 1980s with your legendary head coach actually handing out envelopes in the locker room after games. Why? Because they wanted that bad.
It's one of my favorite universities in all of college sports because not only is all that true, they are ridiculously confidently transparent about all of it. And you don't get that anywhere. Like, they wear it on their chest. It's one of my favorite places to go to because obviously right now they're outside of the Power Five.
Right.
They have this one mega booster, the guy who owns the Rockets. No one acts like Houston does, man. I don't know if that's a Texas thing or if it's that sort of like Southeastern mix that you get in that city, but, they're beautiful about it, man.
Well, the thing is,
they'll tell you the score.
Well, the thing is, they're as big as UT and as A&M is, right?
Oh,
except
doubt,
they're
yeah.
not them. Like, they are the one when it's like, who are we keeping out of this? Who are we keeping out of the major conference, right? TCU? No, we'll go ahead and let you in. That's not such a big deal. Houston is the one that scares them every time.
You've been to those two campuses, though. You start to understand why. There's a lot of coding going on. And again, that's another reason, on a less humorous note, that I like Houston is they will tell you that, too. They will tell you the perceptions against it, that they were a commuter school. They had large, large minority populations before that was a thing you did.
Right.
They are indicative of, I think, one of those schools that suffered the most from suburban white flight.
Yes.
25, 30-ish years ago, where you see, it's kind of funny now, all these schools on the outside, all city schools, right?
Yes.
Almost all those city schools have been pushed out. That's why, like, I look at Louisville and I think it's a miracle.
It really is.
They put together some plans, let's say, to accelerate in a lot of ways because when you got tagged with urban campus, it was a way to be pushed out of what eventually became the Power Five conference.
But it's also funny with Houston is that right around the corner is the urbaner campus, which is Texas Southern, right? And like the inextricable link between those two schools and everything else, like when they come together. But I want to talk to you about the Bagman story because I thought it was so interesting when it came out because it was so decidedly human, right? Like I think that the part of that story is like, yeah, okay, these guys are dropping off money, right? And they're talking to this one person and they're going to this person. But then you had the things where it was like, well, we might be able to help you get your brother out of jail, right? Like we can make a couple phone calls here. Like the reach of what the booster can do goes so far beyond just money.
I haven't read the story in a long time and I was on the train into the city today and I picked it back up. And the one that I love the most after 5 years is getting the tractor fixed.
Yes.
Because if you're from a part of the country where you understand how much tractors cost, again, in the interest of transparency, I put my ignorance in that article where I said, why don't you just buy the dude a tractor? And the guy looked at me and he goes, do you know how much tractors cost? Do you know how much attention that would draw? You can do 8 Camaros for a tractor. But yeah, this entire economy exists in a much more mundane way than people realize. And that's what we wanted to hammer home. The thing we got the most attention for in that article was one, deciding to do it. 2, not playing hall monitor, or as I call it, merit badge media. I borrowed that from Andy Staples, and then I kind of turned it into a thing because it's been very combative in college football media. I must have missed that course where we're supposed to uphold the bylaws.
Right.
I mean, all I see is a really shaky corporation on very, very shaky ground in terms of their future. And to me, that's more newsworthy. So with this culture, we decided to do it. That was the big thing. And then we immediately decided, well, let's find out what we can get. But what we found was boring. And we said, well, let's demystify it then. And what I mean by boring is everyone's perception is SMU in the 80s and then Miami in the 80s and Nevin Shapiro. That's what everybody kind of rolls in together. That's
right.
What fan bases from particular cultures like, just going to throw one out there, Michigan, would have you believe is so toxic about it. And the reality is this. The overwhelming amount of the individuals that the NCAA terms as student athletes – are living near or below the poverty line. They grew up in completely different financial circumstances than most of us. And the favor economy, right, or the gesture economy, whatever you want to call it, is how they come to learn and interact with these university cultures.
Right.
Someone made a really good point to me one time that in the places I've covered the most, which is the poorest parts of the United States of America and the most segregated, that these communities would almost never – certain pockets of these communities would never interact if not for college sports, specifically for this one reason. You see very, very rich white people going into very, very poor black communities and asking essentially – going hat in hand, if you will.
Right.
Where else does that exist in the world?
Right.
It doesn't.
Right. And they're going in kind of like, so who's the person I need to talk to? Right.
That's the hardest thing.
You know, and that's what it is, because you have all these assistant coaches and there's always the one guy, right, whose job it is to know who the people are to talk to. But when you're going into some place that you're not familiar with, the first question you need to ask to figure out how to get this done is – like, who runs things around here? And then you go through that person. That gets you to the next
step. And the more questions you ask, the better the chance you're going to get busted doing it.
Yes.
Or you spend a lot of good money after bad, let's say it that way.
Yeah.
You better know them early on. We wrote about that in the original piece, and I've covered that extensively. The earlier you establish the relationships, be it with the family, with the community, however that particular individual's actual family is structured or his high school family is structured, whoever is raising him, whoever is around him, the earlier you know and earn the trust of those individuals, the more likelihood of your money being successful
right.
in wooing him to a particular place.
Right. And this is kind of like every other quasi-legal business where you are thinking you're dealing with ultimately untrustworthy people, but trust is the grease that makes this whole engine go, right?
Absolutely.
Like especially when you start talking about transferring money. That money's going into probably one person's hands, who's then going to another person's hands, who's then going to another person's hands, dot, dot, dot. And then at some time, lowercase t equals capital T, it gets to where it is. But the only way this works is if everybody has trust down that chain.
You've got to have multiple people between you, the actual football player, and you need multiple people away from anyone associated with the university. When those things do not happen, when you actually hear about duffel bags and Mercedes-Benz trunks opening and all that nonsense, those are the stories you read about because those are idiots doing it. Because
right.
because they saw a movie and they're replicating that, when in actuality, it's just much more boring. You know what's funny is I wrote this story before Venmo.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine it's a whole different culture now because we focus on the $5,000, $10,000, payments before a kid signs. There's a whole – I wrote about it. It's maintenance culture. It's just like if you're listening to this and you've been in college or had a kid in college, you know what I'm talking about. I need $100 for this. I need
right.
to – like, you know, the window motor in my car is broken. Mom, I need that person, that bag man, this nefarious guy ends up being that for a lot of these kids. And so it's a lot of $100 handshakes, but not really in a glamorous way. It's more like, hey, this, you know, I need an oil change. I need $50 to eat this weekend.
Right.
You've got to arrange that meeting.
Right. And football is different than basketball, where basketball, you got like the shoe economy and everything that's around there. Like there's more like legitimate business that sends the money in this way. Football is a much more DIY sort of setup where you really have people who love this football so much that they're willing to endanger their own freedom and break the law to give people money again that they would never give a dime to the people that they don't want their tax dollars going to.
Correct. Exactly. It's not right. It's bizarre, but it's examining those relationships is the most unique thing I've ever done in my career, because you're right. We're not crossing the tracks. We're not crossing socioeconomic. We are crossing worlds. And I think I can't say that enough whenever I get into a national platform like this. If you haven't been to some of these places, and it's not just one city or one state, you know this.
Right.
Like, it's in Southern California, it's in Texas, it's in Florida, it's in Atlanta, it's all over the country, Chicago for that matter. I'll jump back for a second. The shoe economy in basketball ended up being their undoing, as we're watching now, because what you did is you had a corporate, you had a centralized structure. It's much like the way that we write about and the way the government profiles terrorists. Again, I don't want to feed into this image of the bagman as an evil person necessarily, but when it's decentralized, right, when there's not a hub where you can intercept this information, which is it's amazing to read about Nike and Adidas and how sloppy they got.
Right.
It's a lot harder. It's whack-a-mole. And so also the bottom line is one basketball player changes an entire university, right? How many football players do you need to change the culture and the complexion of a football team in the Power Five?
Oh, you know, you need a bunch of them. Like you are an old
– year after year.
Like you're an Ole Miss grad and they had that great year, right, when they brought all those dudes in. Was it Tunsil, Kim DJ, Treadwell, I think
Treadwell
was in that class, all of that.
Magic.
And here we stand and it's like it never happened.
Exactly. But here's the great thing about Power Five football. For as hard as that hammer came down – from the NCAA, from what they were actually able to prove in the kangaroo court situation deal, and they had the other schools ratting on them, and they were paying off kids to say this, or, you know, allegedly.
Right.
Ole Miss could do it all over again next year.
Yes. I mean, that's,
like, they didn't change anything.
No.
And I sat there when they were reading off the stuff in their fake court or whatever, and I've done this since, and, you know, in North Carolina, and anything that involves inducement, I was trying to draw the line to. I'm not talking about what happened in Baylor, but this mission statement that they're going to beat this thing into submission is never going to happen, man. It's never, ever going to happen, okay?
Can't stop money.
Well, the dollar is so much bigger now. And you know, honestly, I don't want to tip my hand or anything, but I look now at these facilities that we're building, right? These kids show up on campus and it's hundreds of millions of dollars and it's holograms and waterfalls, right? All that does is show them
there's money here.
Where their work is going.
Right.
And I, you know, every campus I go to, it doesn't matter how much money they have or don't have, Sun Belt, Big Ten, whatever. Let me show you our building. Man, what do I want to see a building for?
Right.
I've been in a locker room. It's fine. It's all, you know, it's all great. You've got a different version of leather and a new flat screen and whatever. This one folds out or whatever. In the process of hiding the money, the smarter kids are now looking around and going, oh, damn, like I paid for a lot here.
Yeah.
I paid for a whole lot.
Well, that's what Jalen said about being at Michigan is when they started going overseas and they started seeing their jerseys. And that's they were like, oh, yeah. Oh, wait a minute. Somebody's getting paid here and we're not. And when you talk about nothing stopping, like with Ole Miss, when SMU paid Chad Morris that $4 million, mm-hmm. I was like, guys, they're not doing this just to try. Right? Like this is a school. This, and I think they've been on probation like 8 times or something like that through the course of time. Like they're at the top of the dean's list on getting on probation because they want to win so bad, but they're not big enough to actually pull it off. And so they had to go low for a good 20 years. And I don't know what they're doing right now. I just know that they did not pay a coach that much money just to cross their fingers and see how it would go.
Well, college football hates a usurper.
Yes.
So you have multiple entities in college football that enforce that unwritten rule. So you have the NCAA that doesn't like it. You have the leagues themselves that don't like it. And then you have the power structures that come out of these major entities. You could rattle off the first 20 right. names that you think of. That's who I'm talking about. None of them are going to abide by the middle of the pack schools reaching up. And at least it, now.
And that's what happened to Ole Miss.
Achieving dominance is one thing temporarily. Moving yourself truly. We talk about this all the time at Banner Society. Truly changing the complexion of your program and becoming an Oregon.
Right.
It's so rare. And Oregon did it because of the swoosh,
right?
Right? And that was still moving heaven and earth.
And don't forget, they came for Oregon, the Willie Lyle situation.
Absolutely.
Like they, it was still a, hey,
oh, hey man.
Wait a minute, guys, this isn't supposed to happen.
Hey, man, any fortress you show me that's been built in the last 30 years, I can show you where the dirty labor was on that bad boy. And that's what people are asking me, like, oh, okay, well, you went to Ole Miss, you know, are you cover the SEC? You live in Nashville, so it must be Tennessee. It must be Florida. I said, yo, it's everybody.
Yeah.
It's everybody, man. It doesn't work without this. This is how you have to do it, and that's not to speak ill of it. It's just this is the function. These kids, you know, to their credit, are now more aware at an earlier age of the function of things in this sport, and I think that's a good thing, honestly.
I think the new level of this for me is going to be, like, who are the new University of Houstons that are going to pop up? Like, for example, Georgia State is now, like, they've built an alumni base. This is going – and they want to be good at football.
And everybody laughed when they took on that lease for Turner Field, right? Everybody said – because my – so I grew up a Georgia Southern fan. My parents went to school in Statesboro, and they said, that commuter school, the teacher school – what are they? They're buying the Braves Stadium. What are they doing? Starting to work, right? Because you create a location, you create an identity, and all of a sudden these kids, East Point, College Park, wherever, all the way, I mean, even Marietta, doesn't matter. And I don't want to leave town. I don't want to drive 4 hours away or get recruited by Minnesota or one of those guys, right? What's the difference?
And Atlanta's the new South Florida, and what South Florida was in the 1980s in terms of population boom.
Yes.
And now suddenly you have all these players. Because, I mean, the state of Georgia's producing something like what exorbitant number of four-star recruits now. Like, I want to say it's well over 50. It might be closer to 100 that are there. And campus, so many of them go to Georgia, right?
And campus,
so many of them get into Georgia Tech.
The rate of growth in Georgia has been more pronounced than anywhere else, right? Because Florida's been consistent, Texas, at California, all those schools we talk about. And then you have the disproportionate ones, so Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi, West Tennessee, if it was its own state, would look like that as well. Georgia's the one because of everything that you just talked about, the population growth, and also I just think the health of the city of Atlanta. That's the one where we've seen the biggest uptick. And also styles of ball that are played there, too. I mean, there's a lot of good high school coaching.
Yeah, and you see it also happening in Florida, too, with South Florida and Central Florida, like in Florida Atlantic even. They're just like, yo, we have so many good football players here. We can get a few of them, right? Like, we can make something happen.
It's a very old argument of why, I mean, why are you seeing four-star wide receivers from Apopka playing for Wisconsin? That's a hell of a sell, dude. That's a sell I ain't buying. I mean, I'm just saying, like, and so these schools like South Florida, Central Florida, Houston, all of those American Athletic schools and Sun Belt schools that are now kind of considered to be the usurpers, what's the ceiling there? Actually, here's the better question. I'm going to be honest with you. How much are the powers that be going to tolerate that?
Right.
That's the biggest thing. Because if the Big Ten starts losing money wholesale, or if these powers in the South, if this affects them in some way, which right now it doesn't because you're right. Alabama, Georgia, they get to go in and get the cream of the crop. They're not worried about it. You only get 22 at a time anyway. But if it starts to affect some of those larger revenue generating conferences, I think you'll see them step in.
Right. Now, I want to get back to you. You talked about like the idea of doing that story and demystifying the idea of the bag man. What interests me about just the idea of the bag man is you as a guy deciding, yeah, I'm going, like, this is my job in this ecosystem. This is what I want to be. Like, what drew guys to decide that they wanted to be the ones that were actually involved in making it happen?
Oh, man. They do follow a pattern, right? If I'd rattle it off right now, they're almost always native born to wherever they're doing this for, right? So I grew up kind of all around the country. I would probably be ruled out unless I had a ridiculous amount of money, just because it goes back to, oh, who's your mom know? Who's, you know, oh, your dad's folks, or, you know, your people, right? You're in any culture where they use the word people in that connotation. All white, all 30 at the, I'd probably say the youngest 36, 37. I'm 38 years old. I don't know anybody that's my age that does it. It was always guys, when I did the story, it was guys about 10 years older than me at the time, so 5 years ago, all the way up until their 70s and 80s, obviously. So they have a lot of money. I mean, look, man, here's the deal. In all these small towns across Texas and the Southeast and even the Midwest, you make money selling insurance. You make money selling, I don't care what it is, jet skis, you're a dentist, what have you. What do you do? What do you do in America these days? You buy a lake house, you buy a house at the beach, something like that. You got three cars. Then what? You're bored. I think a lot of these people crave identity and authority. It's a tale as old as time in that way. So if you're from one of these small towns in the South, what's equity in those worlds? We know this, right? The whole college football is a religion and all that. So how do you affect the religion? How do you gain importance? Well, you're not a football coach. You're not an athletic director or anything like that. This is how you feel important.
Yeah.
And the ability to purchase that by paying a human being, and I use the word purchase with all the connotation associated with it, because I'm going to be really honest with you. This is far from the ideal way to get these kids money.
Right.
And I don't say that enough when I talk about that story. This is a lopsided relationship, okay, where a lot of bad things can happen to the individuals who receive this money. And I would also like to point out, if you're talking about paying a kid, let's just say an arbitrary amount of $15,000 to $20,000, and I usually hear things that operate in that range, that compared to their market value and what they generate, if you're talking about a Power 5 school or something in the Southeastern Conference, give me a break, man.
Yeah.
Grossly underpaid.
Yeah, it's funny. When we talked to Marcus Spears about it, he talked about being in schools. He'd be like, yeah, the boosters come around, offer you a little money here and there. He's like, but we realized that wasn't free, right?
No.
That once you do that, they own you. Like SMU was interesting because their cheating was so flagrant that the players own the program. But in most cases, it's vice versa.
SMU serves as a test case. So does Miami. Every time someone gets in trouble, this is a learning ecosystem, okay? So if you think about it all as one giant organism, they sort of look and react. And I don't know if you remember the SI story about Oklahoma State a couple years ago. A lot of the guys I talked to at the different schools, and I still talk to some of these guys, some of these bagmen, they didn't believe that Oklahoma State story because the idea, there were like anecdotes of handing out envelopes in the locker room after the game. No, man, because what's that going to do? You handing out everybody an envelope?
Right.
Is it orange slices after the game? It's not, right? So you can't do that. The bounty system was one thing that went away with pretty quick, to be honest. I know that that gets a ton of attention when it comes out in the media, but I've never heard of, seen, had anyone tell me on or off the record that a bounty system was in place. It's hard to enforce.
Right.
Also, kids get mad. If kids get hurt and they lose their earning potential, what are they going to do? They're going to talk.
Right.
So, the best thing to do is splinter any kind of central authority. All of the structures I've seen, there were three schools in the SEC that I used for that piece. They all had the same thing where it was, you're from town X. This is close or from where kid Y is from. We're going to give you these three or four kids. You're going to take care of them. Then they also have a guy that you can call in the university town if there's a problem, something that needs to be taken care of.
Right.
It's decentralized for a reason. So it's not what you would see in the third act of a film, right? It's just not. And people get really frustrated when I say that.
Right. And, you know, when you talk about, you know, we talk about like what is in it for these guys. Like this sounds to me, it's like an extension of what the message board culture has been, right? Like
sure.
It's just like people love the idea of I'm somebody who knows something. Like I'm fascinated by premium. I would love to write something about the people on premium message boards. There's just no way to do it without giving away who they are. People want that place in the ecosystem that badly, basically.
Absolutely. Once media became interactive, you and I know this, right? There was no looking back. You couldn't, right? You had to assume a three-dimensional sort of media profile. And, I mean, that's why when people talk – this is the only media job in the world, unless I miss something on CNN or Fox or something. Like I don't know of a Capitol Hill reporter that goes and says one thing one way or the other about the president, and someone goes, oh, of course. They went to Bama. Like, that only happens in my – like, that's – like, people are Googling my parents' home address in college football media. Like that, this is the only culture that where that kind of stuff happens. And it comes directly from, I would say, that message board celebrity, but also like message board activism.
Yes.
Because you can fake it for a long time on these online cultures and you can rabble rouse extremely well. I have this theory that every single thing the political media and the political culture is experiencing, college football and some sports, we were about 6 or 7 years ahead of you on this. So if you want to ask us how bad it can get, we'll let you know, okay? But this, like, activation of angry social media user, bro, we've been dealing with that for like 15 years now, man. I mean, the internet, as far as I'm concerned, in my corner of the world, was invented for somebody to scream at me about sports.
Right.
The other thing about the Bagman that was interesting in that story is the mentality of these guys where they really feel like they're doing something good. Like the one guy who talked about, like, it's not the money I can give, it's the things that I can do. And he seemed, like, for better or worse, really proud of himself for the contribution he was making to the larger society.
Absolutely, man. Civil rights. I'm dead serious. Yeah, absolutely. They're not wrong in a vacuum. I will say this. I did come across a couple instances where it was clear that the player in question, I have to do mental gymnastics, not to use the phrase student athlete, because it drives me nuts because it doesn't exist. It's not real. The athlete, the football player in question, was on his way out and was not going to be that much more effective, and they were still chipping off money for the guys. I was actually shocked to see that because I kind of thought it was just you kind of feed them dollars as they go up, and if it's a bad investment, you walk away. But they're smart, and I wrote about that at the very end of that story where you have to keep the circle going, right? This is what physical education degrees are for, is that these guys go back to their community. You know, the guy who was the three-star who didn't make it, who was the undersized defensive back or what have you, he becomes defensive coordinator at that high school where he came from, and thus the process continues. And then you use him as the conduit for the next kid.
Right.
So they do feel like they are – patron. They do feel like they're doing something charitable, for sure. Absolutely.
Well, that was the interesting thing about Sherwood Blood and SMU, the infamous line, we've got a payroll to meet. Because for people who don't realize that what got SMU the death penalty, it wasn't so much that they got caught paying players. It's that they got caught paying players and then said, we're going to keep paying them according to the exact same scheme because we have a payroll to meet. Right? Deal's a deal. Really?
Look, man, they honored their – I look at that and I laugh and I'm like, hey, man, that's honest business.
A deal is a deal.
It's kind of contrasts half of what was going on in Dallas in the 80s where I was like, okay, no, they held up to it. Yep. You know? Well, what were the kids going to do, take them to court for breach? I was shocked. But I can tell you why they did that. You know why they did that? Because they thought they were going to get out of it.
Yep.
And that's why they got the death penalty. Before television was so powerful – that it essentially took the teeth out of the death penalty. They gave him the death penalty because by saying we've got a payroll to meet, what they meant was we need to maintain these relationships because the next class and the next class, these moms, uncles, high school coaches, community leaders, whatever, in whatever part of Texas we need to go to, they need to know that if we say we're going to pay, we're going to pay.
Right.
That's why they did it.
Again, the honor of underground, like underground stuff only works on the basis of trust or threats. Yes. Right. And there are only but so many threats that people can issue. Like the dope game works on trust because people trust that you're going to get killed. Right. Like, you show up late, you don't get what you're supposed to get.
You
they
make
trust.
Concessions immediately.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Like that part is understood. But on this one, everybody just has to believe that everybody is going to do the things that they said. And the only way you do that is by doing those things over and over again, repeated iterations.
Well, you touch on something too, because one of the things that we've done in America from Prohibition on through the crack cocaine in the 80s is as we in the media and then Hollywood comes in behind us, we turn these into character arcs, like the whole modern anti-hero. This stuff that I do where a guy's given $500 to a running back and then he gets to go tell his buddies about it on the golf course even though he's not supposed to, right?
Right.
This is armchair gangster. This is PG gangster. Nobody gets shot. Mm-hmm. This is the thing where you get that thrill. It's like guys who go play paintball.
Right.
I mean, that's sorry. Like, I was raised by cops and so I was like guys are like, all right, man, we're going to go play paintball this weekend. Like, that's what this is. Like, I got to go meet this kid and drop $500 off. Like, okay, all right. Well, you're not going to get murdered or anything like that. But they paint the culture with the same colors that it is. First off, none of this is illegal, by the way. I always have to say that up front.
Right. It's not illegal. It's not illegal until they decide to put something on the books like North Carolina did with agents after they got caught up.
Yeah. But handing a kid $500 in your local college town is not illegal in and of itself. The NCAA processes that to a point and they're messaging over and over again where this is a bylaw violation if proven by an NCAA committee, which is their version of a court. That's all it is, man.
Right. And all this stuff is funny to me because when people ask the question when I say that players should be paid, they're like, well, where's the money supposed to come from? Where it comes from right now.
Buddy.
There are all these people who are begging for the privilege of giving this money away.
Again, I'm not in the business of tipping off what I'm working on next. Mm-hmm. But we're talking about $100 million athletic departments. Not just one, right? Not just five anymore. And then a bunch of $80 million athletic departments. Well, they don't have that many employees, man. I didn't go to business school, but I've learned, like, you got $80 million on your budget, and you only have 20 employees. and by the way,
not taking all the money home.
Oh, no. The secretary answering the phone is not bringing down 1.5, okay? Right. So every year, they're faced with a conundrum of, we got to get rid of this money. Is there another business that works like this in America? I'm strapped to think of it, honestly.
No, there's none, right? Another thing, because college football budgets, the other part that's fun is they're so heavily subsidized by donations. Like, you can go through and you'll see the lot of 25-30% of the budget is people just giving them money.
Yeah.
But nobody knows where to get the money
from. Most of the head coaching salaries, I think people don't know this, or it bears repeating, is that, so let's say you're coaching, you're talking about Chad Morris getting $4 million a year. Most states, because these guys are state employees, most states have a cap on the actual financial or the salary that they can pay these guys.
Right.
So like Chad Morris, for instance, and I'm just making this up, but this exists in multiple states where Chad Morris, I think, is compensated something like $110,000 by the state of Arkansas.
Right.
The other 3.9 whatever comes from it's usually something like the Razorback Foundation or one of those deals. Yeah. It's a fun way to hide money from the government. It's a fun way to hide money from athletes. This is a big game to them, man. That's all it is.
And this is the fun stuff that nobody really wants to talk about because we sell a charade, right?
Yes.
Even though I swear I don't see how this wouldn't be more marketable.
What, this part of it?
Yeah, just all of it. It's so much more fun.
I'll say something on the air I've never said before. Story came out in 14. I get flown out to LA like six times over the course of a year. You probably know where this is going, right? So they're like, we want you to meet this producer who's really interested in your story. We're going to turn it into a TV show. We're going to turn it into a movie and all this stuff, right? There exists a divide in this country, and I'm not telling you anything you don't know, so strong that to me it's a mirror of everything that goes on. I would get to these meetings, and they'd be the fancy meetings out, the fancy LA meetings, right, where they'd be like, no, we really think this is an amazing story. Great, okay. We just have one problem, okay? We don't believe it. We don't believe the motivation. Why would someone give? Is it their own money? I'm like, yeah. How much? I don't know, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, $30,000. Yeah, that just doesn't make sense to us. We couldn't make a TV show or a movie about someone who just gave money just because he wanted his college football team to win more games. And I sit there and I'm like, what do I say? Like, how? If there's an old saying about pro wrestling, for those who believe, no explanation is necessary, right?
Right.
For those who do not believe, no explanation will do. And that's kind of how you talk about how more people are not interested in this aspect of it. I think people just don't believe, right? They cannot believe this. It's a little harder, man, when you're from like 100 miles up from New York and you go to one of these private liberal arts schools and you like, you know, you're not really forking out money for the lacrosse team to do this kind of stuff. You either understand this culture you don't it's not about belief, you just know, or it's the most foreign concept in the world.
Well, I tell people about college sports, the farther you get away from people who are in the weeds on it, the crazier it sounds to people. Like when you go try to explain to somebody from another country, just the whole notion of what college sports is, they're like, wait a minute, no. So they're in school? Kinda. Like it's the wildest thing. And when you're so deep in it, you don't think about it. But when you go tell people who don't follow this at all that the players aren't paid, they're like, really? That doesn't make any sense.
I always like to do that with the British because you don't have the language, you don't have the language barrier. And I had an English friend that my wife and I invited to our wedding in Louisiana, and it was,
oh God, I'd pay money for his impressions.
You just start, aside from all the Louisiana of
yes.
it, because he works in sports over in England and we compare notes all the time, and he still to this day goes, all right, tell me how it's set up again. Like he can't even get before you even get to this weird part of it, he can't even understand the structure of some of these schools have teams, some of them don't. But, you know, how are they making this? Why are they on television then? Like, this very much isn't only in America type culture. We say that a lot, but this really is.
That is Stephen Godfrey. Check him out, Banner Society, who is doing this series with us and greatly appreciate it. Check him out at sbnation.com. Also, did you ever do the Ole Miss book?
No, man, I need to. I need to. Wait, I got to wait for a couple NDAs to die.
Yeah.
I'm going to be honest with you. I've had some people before be like, hey, man, this would be, I'd love to talk to you. give me 5 years. I legit had somebody say, I'm going to need about 5 years from you. I'm like, all right, okay.
Well, I'm ready for it because that is a fascinating whole realm of things at Ole Miss. Quietly, like, making itself one of the more liberal institutions in the SEC because they have no other choice. They are fighting ghosts like nobody
else.
Buddy,
you got 50 miles ahead of you. You better start running to catch up. You and I are going to be long dead before they think about doing that.
They're trying.
Oh, man. Are they?
Hey, man, I appreciate it.
Yes, sir.
All right, here we are. We are wrapping up our sideline series. We've done this in conjunction with Banner Society, talking about booster culture in college football. We've had Spencer Hall of Banner Society with us. We had Marcus Spears of ESPN, Stephen Godfrey of Banner Society. And now with us, a dude who once says he was the fastest 10-year-old in America.
I mean, there's an actual certificate that I can bring if you need proof.
Oh, you don't keep a copy with you?
You know what? I brought one to work one time because somebody tried to pull my card on it, and I brought it, and now I can't find it. So
you don't keep like a screen cap, like on your phone?
I should have done that.
So now it's gone. You can't find it.
Yeah, I don't know where it is. I moved like 4 times since I brought that to work.
How much did it hurt to lose it?
Oh, because like now people can just pull my card on it. You know what I mean?
Can you like put in an application and get a duplicate?
The funny thing is, I don't think that organization quite exists in the same way anymore. It's the USATF today, but back then it was called the Athletic Congress. Mm-hmm. So
you ought to call them.
I should see. Maybe I'm sure they got something.
Or at the very least, it's in the record books somewhere.
Yeah, I would hope so.
All right.
It should be.
Now, you also play college football.
Yes.
You played at TCU.
I did.
So what was your booster dealing with life at TCU?
Not at all. it's funny hearing Marcus and Steven and Spencer talk because I feel like I represent the common man, which is like, you know, there's a very small number of people that are 4 and 5 stars that, you know, are highly desired and everybody wants them. I'm more representative of the 0-star recruit in which, you know, you have to kind of, you know, cobble together interest in yourself, and you have to reach out to people and hope that you can kind of get on. And that was sort of my experience.
And now you've covered college football. You're now doing a Slow Burn podcast at Slate. Mm-hmm. You know, we've talked about that. You guys go check that out. I wanted to talk to you about boosters as it relates to getting them coaches out of there.
Yeah,
right. Cause we
yeah.
just saw this happen with Willie Taggart.
Oh, man.
Where 1 week the AD is like, well, basically Willie got to get hit by a bus in order for us to fire him.
Yeah.
7 days later, or not even 7, yo, he got to go right now.
So let's just even – Willie Taggart donated money for a facility that is not yet done at Florida State. They've been trying to get the money to build the indoor facility that would help. It's a competitive disadvantage for Florida State to not have this.
Right.
All of a sudden – they're able to raise the amount of, it was $18 million?
Yes.
For a buyout. All the money just materializes from nowhere. So it makes you wonder, like, hey, why couldn't Willie Taggart get the money that he needed when he needed it? But all of a sudden now, it's like, all right, we found $18 million. We found whatever, you know, would help go towards this indoor facility.
Well, you know, Florida State also has a very interesting situation in that their booster club and the athletic department basically merged.
Yeah.
Like, they're the same people. So when people are asking on this one, will boosters be involved in the hire? Of course, they're pretty much always involved in the hire.
Absolutely.
And by the way, ask Charlie Strong, if they're not involved in the hire, it's bad news.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing is, you need them, but also they could be the end of you.
You know
what I mean? Right. Like, you want them, you need them to be involved in the process. You want to cultivate them and have relationships with them, but there's only so much you can do.
Right.
And I mean, we're sort of skirting by the obvious. I know we'll probably get into it, but it's like black coaches are just naturally going to have a very different relationship. They're not going to, the level of support that they're going to get from the old white men who are boosters is not going to be the same as somebody like Mac Brown who, you know,
right.
is going to be hanging out at the same country clubs with them.
Right. Well, Mac figured it out, right? Like, I've talked about this, I think, with Spencer. Mm-hmm. First thing Mac did when he got to Austin is he hired Joe Jamail as his lawyer, right? Yeah. Hire the richest man nearby, hire the biggest swanging thing that's around here. And that really did save his job when it was a little dicey early.
Oh, right? Incredible power move.
Right. Yeah. And by the way, it's crazy that they were getting ready to fire him for what was superior to the previous guy. But it was just like, yo, this should be better.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the thing is that Texas was, even in those early days, like the Chris Sims era, I know you're not a Chris Sims fan. Like, is that right?
I have calmed down.
I don't want to bring up some ugly times.
Yeah, I've calmed down.
Okay. They were clearly better than they had been in like the previous 20 years, but losing to OU in those ways was like really embarrassing. It's the same sort of thing that gets you, you know, that gets coaches fired all the time. They got Les Miles fired at LSU. They got, who was a homeboy?
John Cooper.
Cooper.
He got longer than he should have, but this is what got him fired.
Yeah, right. Losing to your rival in that way will get you fired. But Mac Brown was able to hold on because of that relationship.
Yep. And that one is where it gets crucial. And that's why I say with Strong, Steve Patterson, who was the AD for about 15 minutes and in that time hired Charlie Strong and Shaka Smart, right?
Right.
But he didn't run it by the boosters. It was clear that they were not involved in this discussion. And what you had basically was, I won't say a booster mutiny when Charlie got the job, mm-hmm. but wasn't everybody like, hey, this is our new coach and we're behind him. It was a lot of, we don't know this dude. Let's see. Which can never be the way that you start with your coach.
I mean, what was it? Red McCombs had said, I think he'd make a fine offensive coordinator.
Defensive coordinator, yeah.
But like a head coach don't know about it.
Yeah.
I mean, Steve Patterson is bad. I mean, I admire the idea that he was able to try to hire those two dudes at that institution. Cause if you're from Texas, and I mean, man, we had to get into why you're a UT fan someday, but if you hire two black coaches at that institution in Texas, that is a very bold and courageous move.
Yes.
But like,
He didn't do it right.
And Steve, I mean, people forget Steve Patterson is a dude who almost ran Hakeem Olajuwon off the Rockets.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
He's a pro sports guy.
Yeah. He's a pro sports dude. Yeah.
Yeah. And to answer your question, dude went to high school and played for Texas. And so, like, it kind of goes.
That's how that, okay.
Yeah, it kind of goes from there. Okay. And look, man, if you from Texas and you gonna root for something local, you ain't got a lot of great options here in terms of history.
That's true. Well, so I grew up a U of H fan.
Yeah, and that makes more sense. Yeah. Right? But see, you're from a part of the city where that feels more like home.
Right.
To you, right? Like that's more local to your existence.
Right, right. I went to I went to kindergarten at TSU's development lab. So I'm right over in there, third ward.
And you're just enough older than me that there's some things that you can have a recollection of that I don't.
Like
I don't have any recollection of college. And we weren't even in Houston at that time. But I don't have any recollection of that sort of thing. Like Houston meant something different at that time than it did. But like, why do you root for Texas? What I'm going to do? Root for Texas A&M.
Okay, this is confusing because we always, again, we talk about how, you thought Georgetown was a black college.
Yes.
I kind of thought Texas A&M was mad brothers back then.
Why? Based on the Wrecking Crew jerseys?
The Kente Clough jerseys and the Wrecking Crew. Like, I was just like, what? Quinn Corriott, all these cats.
Sam Adams.
I'm like, well, I mean, they got a lot of brothers. And Greg Hill, he didn't seem like the kind of dude. Greg Hill, could you imagine him playing at the University of Texas?
At that time, it'd be a little tricky.
Yeah.
Right?
Jackie Sherrill, it just kind of seemed like they had a little bit of a different culture.
Well, that's the thing. The Jackie Sherrill era could lead you. I mean, Jackie Sherrill had Kevin Murray playing quarterback, right?
Right, in the early 80s.
Yeah, so yes, the Jackie Sherrill era might be able to trick you. But on the booster thing, I think that's where it is, though. Like, we've talked so much about this with regards to players, but the above board stuff that they're able to do really is about the coach market. And like what I say happened to Taggart was, they fired him because they wanted to.
Right.
Right? Like, it's not about, there's no logic to what will or will not get you fired, what will or will not help you keep your job. Right. It's a matter of, do these guys want you to be gone? And they are not here based on any logic. Mm-hmm. They are here because they got the money to be here.
Right, right. And it's hard to win if you don't have their support, right? Like, if they don't have to say anything. They also don't have to do anything either. And that's like when you can see with Willie Taggart early on, it was going out of the way. Cause if you can't raise the money for that facility that they've been trying to get, you could tell very early that like there was not a lot of support for him in those suites.
Right.
And if you don't have that, it's just, I can't think of a coach who has succeeded in spite of the fact that their boosters are like, only kind of halfway in on them. You know what I mean?
Can't be done. And by the way, I always say this with Saban down there. And me and Spencer talk about this all the time, and people think we're exaggerating, but we're not. Let them go 10-2 this year, and the seat gets hot.
You think so, man?
It don't matter who it is.
He lost three games.
In 2010, and they won the national championship the next year.
That's true.
If they had, if they had gone 10-3 and then gone 10-3, he would have been on a blazing hot seat.
You think, even at this point, after all of this,
it don't matter what you did, This is about what it is that you gonna do.
That's a fair point.
That's how that place goes. And see, the thing with Saban is, it sounds like they've kind of insulated him from having to deal with all the boosters and everything that comes from it. But what that means is that their affection for him is conditional.
Right.
And once the condition doesn't come through, because look, here's something I think people need to get. Alabama still got this thing rolling, but you're going to look at the recruiting list for this year.
Uh-huh.
Clemson has 6 5-stars.
Oh my God.
So far. So that's like 6 of the top 30 players in the country, basically.
Right.
They have 6 of them. Alabama got 3. Right. And there have been years Alabama was bringing in 5, 6, 7, somewhere in there.
I mean, they had the top ranked recruiting class for like 7, 8 years in a row up until recently.
Yeah. But I'm telling you, once people look at that and they're like, yo, the recruiting's starting to slip.
Well, you mentioned this the other day.
At Saban.
It doesn't take long for things to get wobbly. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like all of a sudden it can be over just like that.
Right.
Nobody thought Mac Brown was going to fall apart like that after 2009.
Nope.
You see Garrett Gilbert come in, have a good half. You're like, okay, maybe something's gonna come up. Nah, it can run off the rails that quickly. And you know what? Now that I'm thinking about it, you're right, because Nick Saban is like not the kind of person that would engender like those sort of like warm feelings of a dude like Bear Bryant. Like he's not an icon there. Like he is a great coach and everybody respects him as such, but like there's not going to be the sort of hagiography over that.
Like their identity is not tied to him like it is to Bryant.
Right.
Right. Like this is what you can provide.
Right.
Right. And then the booster class at Alabama becomes interesting in terms of talking about coaches and stuff like that. Because number one, the most important man with anything to do with that is Paul Bryant Jr.
Yes.
Do you know what Paul Bryant Jr. does now? Mm. He owns a bank.
Oh man.
He owns a bank.
Oh man.
Think about that for a second.
Oh my God.
He owns a bank, right? And like the booster class at Alabama is so powerful that they can shut down what happens at UAB.
Right.
Because they think it's a threat to what's going on
at
Alabama.
Jimbo, man.
Yes.
I mean, that's like, they thwarted Jimbo.
Yeah, we talked about this a couple weeks ago, but for those who didn't hear it or are unfamiliar with this story, in 2007, Alabama Birmingham wanted to hire Jimbo Fisher as their head coach. He's the offensive coordinator at LSU at the time, and he was down to go, and the legislature and the board were like, nope, this is not going to work. We got a couple theories as to why it didn't happen. One theory has been, well, maybe Jimbo was going to be Saban's offensive coordinator, and that's why they shut it down. The other theory has been, if UAB has a coach that's better than Alabama's coach, because Alabama didn't have a coach at the time, if they get one that's better than Alabama's coach, that's going to be a bad look,
right?
And we don't want that. And so we're going to shut this down. And that's all booster activity, man.
Well, not only that, UAB had to shut down its program. Don't think the Alabama boosters didn't have something to do with, like, they've never wanted UAB.
No, when UAB got it started, Bryant said, why do they need a football program? They got us.
Right.
Like, they don't see them. That program does not see itself as simply representing the school.
Right.
They see themselves as representing the whole state.
The whole state, right. And so it's just like, I mean, it was possible for UAB to go away because UA wanted them to go away. And it's the same reason you talked about earlier, that University of Houston has so much trouble getting footing in Texas, because Texas and them are like, hey, man, like, we don't want you guys. Like, there's no need for you to be any good.
No, and they got that want to.
Right.
That's the thing about, like, we grew up in the era of the Southwest Conference. Like, we are aware of the Southwest Conference. Let's go through everybody that got thrown on probation out of the Southwest Conference.
7 of the 9 schools. And you know who the two that weren't probation?
What, Texas and Rice?
No. Arkansas and Rice.
Arkansas
avoided it, yeah.
I didn't know Texas got caught.
Yeah,
up.
Texas got caught, but on some minor stuff. You know what I mean? But like, yeah, Arkansas and Rice were the only two that didn't get caught up in that era, which is just sort of, you know, indicative of the want to in Texas.
Well, did you see the 30 for 30 they did on SMU?
Oh my God. That's one of my favorites.
Amazing.
Oh,
but what they described, and I think it was Skip who talked about this, is what you had to understand was that the culture of it was these offices in Dallas with the oil dudes, because crude was booming, right? Like the '80s were a great time for oil prices. And it was all these guys coming in on Monday morning in those offices with all this money to blow.
Yeah.
And the competition among them is what brought really that era of the Southwest Conference and coming around. They almost shut the doors completely on TCU. They shut the doors completely on SMU. Baylor was a top 10 team in the middle of the 80s. You knew what that meant.
Right.
U of H, they always trying to get down.
Man, look, man, it don't take, you know, they're going to be in the game one way or another. You know what I'm saying?
Yes. Jackie Sherrill, got caught. Anytime A&M's been good, the NCAA has shown up.
There's a crime going on. But I say that, I'm not being this to be a hater, but I always say, like, when Baylor is good.
Oh, come on, man.
I was like, they can't do that. Have people been to Waco? You know what I mean? Like, I was like, they only can be good with something bad.
Some level of shenanigans. Right,
yeah, right.
Like, either we bankrolling this or we're just turning our head away at a whole bunch of stuff.
We just letting them in. Come on.
Yeah.
Come on down.
I ain't heard nothing.
Right, yeah.
I ain't seen nothing that you did. I think who else did we? Texas Tech got on probation.
Oh, yeah, man. But you know Texas Tech cheat too, man?
Yeah.
They did.
That's how we'll put it.
Right.
Seven of the nine. And these dudes just want it. It's so they can walk around amongst their partners and be like, yo, not only is my school balling, but I did this.
Right. But that want to and that and whatever, though, can be ultimately destructive, as you saw. And, like, I wonder, like, at what point there's going to be a tipping point in the Southeast Conference with all this want to, all these different schools that are competing, you know, all these boosters that are, like, desirous of having top 10, top 5 programs. That doesn't seem sustainable long term to me.
Well, because it's unsustainable for all of them to be top 10, right?
Right.
Like, top 10 only got 10.
Right.
You know, and that becomes the issue. And so you wind up with the schools. So the thing about the SEC that gets lost, there are 14 schools in the SEC.
Mm-hmm.
There are 6 of them that will never win the SEC.
Ooh, chance. Hold on. I'm trying to count now. Okay, so that's Vanderbilt?
Yes.
That's Kentucky?
Yes.
South Carolina?
Yes.
Two
of them in the same state.
Oh, the Mississippi State.
Yes.
But wait a minute. But they almost did.
That's all I got to say. That's right. You saw as good as it's going to get.
So it's either going to be Arkansas or Missouri is the other one.
Oh, I'm sorry. 7.
Okay.
Not 6. 7.
Okay, so Arkansas or Missouri?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Yes. Because keep in mind, Missouri's best chance to do it was when they could still recruit Texas.
Right.
Right.
Missouri should have taken it. They should have gone on to the Big Ten, man.
That's what they wanted. The Big Ten just didn't want them.
Right.
They're a much better fit in the Big Ten.
Right. They wanted that going back as far as the 90s, too.
Yes. Well, the thing about that conference realignment as related to the Big Ten that I think gets lost for people is that the Big Ten is the only athletic conference that is also a brand name to academics.
Yes.
Every single Big Ten school is an academic heavy hitter of some variety.
Mm-hmm.
None of the SEC schools, other than Missouri, and you could say Vanderbilt, maybe. People don't view them in that same way. Texas, the Big 12, really only Texas and kind of sort of, Texas A&M ain't there no more.
Yeah.
And Texas A&M kind of sort of in the SEC.
Right.
But it's really Texas and kind of sort of Oklahoma.
I guess, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
Like that people really, like that professors.
Well, this is why Texas has been for years, even dating back to the late 80s, early 90s, has been trying to align themselves with the Pac-12. Or it wants the Pac-10.
Right.
They've always wanted, because they like that academic association. They want to be with that. They know that they don't have as much in common with the schools and their regional footprint. But
right.
It's just a very difficult thing to work out. And they have in Texas, speaking of boosters, they have these obligations to these other programs that, you know, the state legislators will not, they just won't allow them to leave.
Correct.
Leave them behind.
Yeah. And this got me thinking more like with boosters, and we talk about this, is that when you got a school that ain't supposed to be good, all you gotta have is one, right? Like one guy who decides, now we gonna do this. Boone Pickens was the guy at Oklahoma State.
People don't understand that Oklahoma State had been bad or a mediocre program for most of our life. With the exception of like that Jimmy Johnson era. But like Boone Pickens, if you've never been to Stillwater, Oklahoma, I can't explain to you how remote it is. One time I drove up there and there was a coyote on the highway in the middle of the day. Like that is how remote, how far away it is. And Boone Pickens basically built a franchise in Stillwater, Oklahoma. And that's how powerful he was.
And he found the coach that wanted to be there,
mm-hmm.
right? And Mike Gundy, they got an alum.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to know what the overall record is in the Bedlam series?
Oh, my God. We should also give credit to Les Miles, because Les Miles.
Yeah, he won those two games that I can't believe they won.
Yeah.
Right? Like that 0-1 and 0-2 game where you just look at it and you're like, oh my God.
He talked a little too much in 0-3 and it got him hurt next year.
That was the wrong team.
Yeah.
To be going up against and talking right. about. All right. So from 1946 to 1964, Oklahoma State didn't win a single game that series. And then they won two and bless their hearts. And then they went out there and they lost 9 in a row. And then they won one. And then they went out there and they lost. Wow, I can't even count this. So basically between 94 and 77 and 94, Oklahoma State pulled off a tie.
Wow.
A tie.
Do you know who, I mean, think about it. That's a Jimmy Johnson, Barry Sanders, Thurman Thomas era of Oklahoma State,
yes.
Too, by the way.
Yes.
That just happened, too. They get stumped.
And those weren't great Oklahoma teams like 88, 89, 90. No, they still out there beating Oklahoma State.
Wow.
And so Boone Pickens is like, yo, no. I have all the money in the world. Now, granted, he gives money to other stuff, too.
Right.
Right? I mean, gave, rather. But no, this man's like, I want my school to be good at football.
Right. And again, the other farm school in this equation, for instance, is Texas A&M.
Yes.
Like, they have a crazy booster class. I mean, man, Tony Busby, who's running for the mayor of Houston right now, I mean, they are ridiculous. They've come up with money for anything. I mean, that's why Jimbo Fisher is being paid what he's paid right now. Texas A&M has an insane amount of want to. They want to be so good, and they spend so much money, and it just really, like, you kind of see in college football that, like, there's a cap, though, on programs. And it makes it really difficult. Even if your boosters want you there, it can be really difficult.
Yeah, and it's all fun and games for A&M as long as the crude price is riding high.
Yeah.
That's the thing with their booster class is that the Jimbo's money, that crude price is riding high. That crude price falls, everything changes because that's where the money for the booster class is coming from, is oil.
Right, right. But, man, A&M's not been bad in our lifetime, though. Have they? Have they ever been bad?
Not, like, bad.
Not like 4-8 bad.
Yeah, they're not abject.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, Slocum never had a bad team. Your man, Fran Jody.
Coach Fran, what's up, man?
Yeah, man, that's your guy.
That's what's up, man.
I get the feeling that you liked him.
I felt bad for him because I thought Alabama overwhelmed him, and he would say that. And then he got to A&M, and I thought there really was some promise for him there, and it just kind of fell apart for him. I think he's like, I don't often think that coaches care about their players. I thought that Coach Fran did sort of care, like, you know, as much as a coach can care. You know what I mean? And so I felt bad for him. I thought I don't think he got a raw deal. I think, you know, it was what it was.
And he had one 4-8 year.
Yeah, that last one. Was that the first one? Oh, really?
It was that year they lost 77-0 to Oklahoma, when Oklahoma literally could have scored 120 points.
I was at that game. I covered that game.
Really?
Yeah. And I the funny thing I wrote in the game story, I was like, if A&M had 12 players on the field, they still would have lost. You know what I mean? Like, if they really had the 12 men out there, they would have got beat that day.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable. It was surreal to see a FBS program as proud as A&M lose like that.
Mm-hmm.
It was ridiculous.
Let me tell you another booster level with this stuff that I think is interesting is a program like Miami.
Ooh.
That
Evan Shapiro, what's up?
Yeah, but they don't have that much want to.
Yeah.
They're willing to be good, but they don't really have the want to.
They think that, like, they don't have to do that. Don't you think it must be that they just think, oh, we have location in terms of, like, just the location of the campus and the location of the recruits.
Yeah.
Like, it should sort of sell itself because they don't even have the facilities.
Right. But the other part was when they got it early, they weren't expecting it.
Right.
Right. Like, they didn't think it was going to come, and they really didn't think it was going to come the way that it came.
Oh,
right.
Yeah.
Like, they did not think the program, they thought the championships are good for the brand. Right. They did not think the program was good for the brand. But what that means now is the people that care the most about Miami football are those former players.
Oh,
and
yeah.
they got to, and then trying to figure out how to balance that.
Yeah.
Is a tricky game for them.
Well, I mean, like, the thing is, yeah, those guys, they only have but so much influence. They have the want to, but, like, they don't necessarily have the capital.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's always this tension, and you can see whenever Miami is bad, looking at Luther Campbell's, Twitter account is something, boy. And he got a whole bunch of ideas about what they can be doing, but that ain't got nothing to do with building nice indoor facilities, having an on-campus stadium, all the things that you would want for a program of its caliber in tradition, but they just can't, for whatever reason, they just can't do it. You
right.
know?
I would love to know more about, like, the booster class at BYU.
Oh.
Like, we talked about, I did the shutdown forecast yesterday, and we're like, so what if they have, anybody over there is down to slide a little dough. under the table to make it happen.
I mean, the thing is, it's kind of difficult. They just got to convince people to go.
Yes.
That's the thing. I mean, that's a problem for a lot of colleges, especially that one.
Yeah.
Because there was a dude from Eric Dickerson's hometown that went to school there. And I remember thinking, I was like, man, is that dude Mormon or what? You know, what's going on? He lasted like a semester.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's a very difficult sell.
I just feel like the best perk, perhaps, at least in the mind of an 18-year-old, of being a college football player at BYU is actively trying to prevent. They are actively interfering with.
They'll run you up out of there over it.
Yeah.
I mean, they got rid of one of their 6 foot.
Yeah.
You know, their basketball.
Yes, they did.
Yeah.
Have you ever watched The Last Waltz? Great line in The Last Waltz where, Robbie Robinson was talking about they were going to play with Ronnie Hawkins' band and Ronnie told him, and I quote, "You're not going to make much money." And that's kind of the sale of college football.
Right.
Right? Like, that's kind of what college football is offering. And BYU was like, nah, not even that.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, so many programs say that. I mean, that it's tacitly a part of the sales pitch, right? And the only time I've ever heard of a guy say it out loud was allegedly Kendall Briles. Like, which just show you how wild the Briles family is. The only time anybody's been like, hey man, if you come down here, we're going to take care of you. But that governs a lot of like who can be good and who's not going to be good, unfortunately. But 18-year-old boys, you know?
Yep. What I mean? So we got like UCLA is a school that they got the academic restriction.
I was just going to say about USC, man. Because USC, like, I mean, you would think they've got the money, they've got the booster class. What is it? The thing about USC is that really in my lifetime, USC is sort of similar to Texas to me in that the expectations for the program are all much higher than the results have been. USC has had that one run in my lifetime with Pete Carroll.
Yes.
Outside of that, they're like a 9-3 program.
Yeah, overall, well.
Unless you go back to the 70s.
Yeah, well, what
John Robinson.
Right, but what they are is a program that did its best work when the Southern programs weren't recruiting black people.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
This is like Ohio State in the 80s had a long run where they were a 9-win program. And even under Cooper, by and large, except for that run in the middle of his time, they were basically a 9-win program. And then when Tressel got there, they weren't a 9-win program, but the results were fairly predictable, that national championship notwithstanding. And then Urban was like, yo, I'm going to the South to get players.
Right.
And then it was like, oh, okay, we got it.
Florida, Texas.
Yeah.
Getting all those cats.
Yeah, like that was it. Like, yo, man, Ohio is not – they barely recruit Ohio anymore.
Oh, yeah. They're a national – I mean, I always am like – oh man, it feels like for like the last 4 or 5 years, Ohio State's had some dude from Missouri City, and I'm just like, they didn't used to recruit down there when I was in the 90s. When David Boston went there, that was really like, oh, I didn't even know they were checking for people down
How
here like
in
that.
How the world does Texas not get David Boston?
Man, David Boston's a different cat though.
David Boston is probably, of my time in Houston, the best athlete that the city produced.
So David Boston in his senior year was also, was he the basketball player of the year too? I think he was.
I don't know if he was basketball player of the year, but
he was on the first team.
But he hit the shot that sent him to the state semis.
Right. And I don't know why I did that. I actually went to the school who was the Houston area player of the year. But.
Oh, was it Mike?
Mike
LeBlanc.
Yeah, Mike LeBlanc. Shout out Mike. He was first team all city or first team all area in basketball.
Yes.
In a major. And then he was the Houston area player of the year in football.
At quarterback,
yeah.
Yeah. He went to Humble.
He went to Humble, man. Yeah, I mean, which is when Humble used to be like a pretty good program, David Boston, man, I'll never forget going to watch him at the Astrodome in the playoffs. And I went with my boy and he got a scholarship to go play a receiver at another school. And he was like, man, I'm as good as David Boston. And that next play, like David Boston did something that just like, you know, I was like, are you serious, man? Look, are you looking at this dude? I was like, you tripping right now.
Now, yeah. I ask you this about when you were at TCU. You didn't have the booster interaction, but did you see it?
Yeah, because, like, it depended on, like, off-season jobs you might be able to get, the relationships that people had after games, like the people that, you know, that, like, LaDainian would talk to or, you know, Max Nakia. I'm trying to think of who our quarterbacks, like Jeff Dover. Like, those dudes, they had relationships and talked with those dudes, and you would see them, you know. You know, they'd be at the, our workouts or whatever, because we had a thing called Night of the Champions. And so they'd be there. They'd be there just to watch us like work out. You know what I mean? Which I thought was a little weird. A little weird. Yeah. But they were always sort of like a presence. You know, I didn't necessarily have conversations with them or whatever, but you would know, you could see that, hey, maybe a guy got a pretty good internship at this place. If they were interested in that sort of thing.
Right.
If you weren't interested, then they weren't offering. But also TCU at that time was just a really different place when I was there. Like it wasn't the, It was not the program then that it is today. Well,
Gary gave him a different one, too, because Gary told him what was possible.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and also, shout out Coach Fran, man. Coach Fran came in and was like, oh, like, you guys ain't even lifting weights right, you know? Mm-hmm. And it was just a big – like, he upgraded everything, and then Gary was able to sort of take it over and, like, and really take it to that next level. But when I was at TCU, just to give you an indication of how bad things were – we had our locker room. We had to walk a half mile to our practice field. We had to cross a major street, and it was like up a dirt hill or whatever. So I'm like, you know, like that's like people don't do that now. Like now, you go from the locker room, you walk right upstairs, and the practice field is right mm-hmm. there. But back then, it was just like, you know, there are some high schools today that had better facilities than TCU had in the 90s.
And the boosters are the ones that make that happen.
Yeah, right. That's right. I mean, because they were like, oh, they see that it's viable, and they start to pitch in and, you know, spend a little money. And it's like, okay, there you go.
You know, if these cats ain't giving the money, this stuff doesn't happen. The thing is, that means you got to listen to them.
Well, man, think about what SMU must have done. They must have ran their guys. I mean, they had to have run their guys off.
They had no choice.
Yeah. I mean, has anybody talked to Sherwood Blunt?
He has stayed low.
I've never even seen an interview with him.
I've never seen an interview with him either. Right. But what's funny about it is when it came out, he was making a play that people make all the time in doing all of this. He played it to become Craig James' agent. That's the part that gets lost in
this. That's
it. As Craig James swears he didn't take a dime, Sherwood Blunt is your agent.
Like, right.
Okay, buddy.
Right, yeah. It's like, I'm sure that relationship just happened.
Like, look, he giving money to everybody else, and he ain't giving money to you, and you signed with him? that's the guy that's looking out for you?
Right.
Okay, Craig.
Right. I mean, man, Craig, man.
Yeah. Okay. And it's gonna, I mean, as the money changes, too, it's like the generation of who the money changes, this is all going to be very, very interesting to watch how it goes.
Yeah, man. I mean, I'm going to be real curious to see, like, the thing is, it's going to depend heavily on – for this next generation, like which schools are willing to invest enough to keep up with the Joneses. So I think about a school like there's going to be a whole class of schools like USF and all these schools like they're going to have to make a decision. Like, where are we going to go? Are right. we really willing to stay up there? And is Florida going to allow you
right.
to be there with them? And right. I just don't think that.
Well, that's where it gets fun, right? Because we're dealing with the next generation of schools.
Yes.
I think that gets lost. Like these commuter schools that then decided they wanted to have big time programs is basically. In the 60s and 70s, you wind up with this huge demand for higher education spurred largely by the Vietnam War,
mm-hmm.
right? And then you got the GI Bill is getting guys home after World War II in Korea, and then you have that. And then you got Vietnam where people are trying to not go to war, therefore mm-hmm. they're putting more people into school and everything else. And so now you have like those U blank Fs or F blank Us, they're so big. They're all like 50-something thousand students. FAU, mm-hmm. FIU, UCF, USF. All those schools are giant, and one of them is going to be University of Houston, where you get yourself a booster class that's like, oh, no.
We
going to make this happen right here.
Isn't that UCF? That's UCF.
I think they're up there. Like, USF has demonstrated at points that they could beat that school.
USF, their only problem is that, again, their booster class is broke as hell.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Tampa's not an area. I lived in Tampa for 4 years. That's not an area with a lot of money, a right. lot of industry. And to the extent that it existed is in the tourism industry.
Yeah. Wow.
You know what I mean?
Who's going to Tampa for tourism?
Bush, I mean, man, Gardens, you know, Bush Gardens? Hey, man, well, you know, St. Pete, the beaches and
okay,
all that.
Okay,
it's
okay,
kind of
okay,
nice.
Okay,
you know?
Okay. Yeah, I never would have thought of such a thing.
Yeah, man. It does have that. There are people that if you don't want to spend a lot of money going to Miami, you can go to Tampa.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. But they got to get the right rich people.
Right.
You know, like I say, Houston is demonstrated. They'll do whatever.
Houston has everything too. Like they have every industry, and they have all kinds of classes of rich people. Like,
yes.
You know, the biotech, medical industry, petrochemical industry. They've got everything that you need in place.
Right.
The issue is like, is Texas and Texas A&M going to allow it to happen?
And as the University of Houston will tell you, the answer is no.
Right. Right. There's no, I mean, I'm a TCU alum. I love my school, but there's no reason that they should be in the Big 12 or University of Houston.
Mm-mm.
If you think about it.
Mm-mm. None whatsoever.
Right.
There's no logic to it. TCU doesn't fit the profile of the conference.
Right.
None of it. There's no logic except we think we can still be good even with them around.
Right. The Southwest Conference broke up because of schools like TCU. You know what I mean? Like, it was like Texas and Texas A&M were tired of sharing, like, revenue with these schools. They're just like, you guys bring nothing to the table.
Right.
We don't need you for the Dallas market. You know what I mean? Like, nobody, like, when people talk about, like, oh, well, they brought in TCU for the Dallas or Fort Worth market.
That's not how
it works.
People
there don't care about them, man.
That's not how it works.
Yeah, right, right. They, like, be third or fourth in the pecking order.
Yeah, like, SMU maybe.
Right.
Could have given you that.
Right.
Maybe. But no.
People also don't know that, like, Dallas and Fort Worth, even though they call it the DFW area, they're not really close or the same.
They're not at all.
They're
not at all. I think they're more similar than Dallas wants to acknowledge, but they're not the same. Dallas and all that fake money.
Man, Dallas is Atlanta.
Oh, no. The difference in Atlanta, though, the cats who say they got money in Atlanta actually do have money, right? The thing with Dallas is the money ain't real. The money is fictitious.
You don't think, I thought that was backwards. I always thought of Atlanta as a place where people pretend they got money.
Well, I mean, okay, to be fair, there's that. But I say there's a difference between Houston and money, Houston and Dallas.
Oh.
Houston move on cash. Dallas move on credit.
There you go. I feel that.
You see what I'm saying?
No, absolutely.
Like Dallas, whoo boy, Dallas. Remember this, Dallas used to do more plastic surgery business than L.A.
Oh, man, that's a good point.
They tell you everything you need to know.
Yeah, absolutely.
About the way they get down. But, hey, that's my man, Joel Anderson.
Check out
the Slow Burn podcast on Slate. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time, and thanks for checking out our Sideline series in conjunction with Banner Society. Thanks to them. Thanks to all our guests, Spencer Hall of Banner Society, Marcus Spears of ESPN, Stephen Godfrey of Banner Society, also Joel Anderson of Slate. Also, thank you to our sponsor, Manscaped. Remember, subscribe to The Right Time wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars, I'm inclined to think you are a hater. And we'll talk to you in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.